Good morning. I'll call the meeting to order. We do not have a quorum yet. We will shortly, if past is any precedent. We have with us this morning, today we're going to work on waters, and groundwater in particular. And we're fortunate to have with us folks from Minnesota Groundwater Association. Y'all want to come on up and we'll get started. We appreciate your giving us the slides early, so they are in members' packets, so folks can follow along both as you present your slides and on their desks, too. So, if you'd like to get started by giving us your name for the record.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate the invitation. My name is Jeff Stoner.
My name is Dale Setterholm.
And we represent officers of the Minnesota Groundwater Association. We appreciate the invitation to talk a little bit about the hidden water resource of Minnesota. So, should we just go ahead and start? And how do you want to work this?
Yes.
Okay. let's see if I get this thing right. We'd be remiss if we didn't tell you who we are. So this is our pretty much our primary objectives on the screen. We are a voluntary organization made up of some 600 members throughout Minnesota and even outside of Minnesota, mostly professional practitioners, academia, government employees, and so forth, and students. And some of our main issues that we try to do is things like what we're able to do here. We've not done too many of these kind of briefings, but promote and encourage the scientific and public policy aspects of groundwater, establish a common forum for scientists. We have two technical conferences a year and sometimes a field trip, and I think some of you have been on some of those field trips. Education of the general public regarding groundwater resources, and finally, dissemination information through meetings of the membership, as well as we have a newsletter that comes out four times per year. And then hopefully this kind of forum will be useful to you guys. We were asked to talk about what are the big broad issues in groundwater in Minnesota. And these are very broad, but we think these are big ones. And I talked with Representative Virginius ahead of time, and we kind of agreed on these two big ones. Sustainable groundwater supply and prevention of contamination. And the reason we're not talking about cleanup is a lot of that's already happened, and it's very expensive, and you'll see a theme throughout the talk that pay me now or pay me later. Pay me now is a much more efficient way to protect the groundwater resources of Minnesota. And I'm going to spend quite a bit of time talking about the fundamental information, hopefully to solve specific problems in one or two. What do we know? We were asked to say, well, what do we know? And you're going to see a lot of generals in front of every one of these sentences, but I want to go through them. And if you would, keep in mind, I know groundwater is a hard concept unless you have a very large backhoe or if you've been in a cave in Minnesota. It's a hard concept to grasp. And so I ask you to think about something that you might be more familiar with, and that's lakes. And think about what you would do, what kind of information you would need to understand a lake in Minnesota. You'd need to know something about its dimensions. You'd need to know something about where the water comes from, how it exits, the biological activity around the lake, and so forth. And so keep that in mind. I'm going to circle back to that at the end of this talk. In general, we have a pretty good idea of the setting of the basic framework statewide of the geologic character of Minnesota, and that's fundamental for groundwater. Specifically, we have some pretty good maps and atlases for certain counties, particularly in high population areas like the metro area down by Rochester, and more recently in the Fargo-Moorhead region when the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation had to put together a needs and options report, and it accelerated some of the geologic framework for aquifers up in that area, and we'll show you some examples. General water use by user type, like irrigation, drinking water supply, and so forth, is pretty well known on an annual basis. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources gathers that information, and somewhat by aquifer. General hydrologic properties of major aquifer groups, and by that I mean bedrock, dolomites, sandstones, sands and gravels in glacial sediments that blanket most of this state are generally known. We generally know the direction of flow of groundwater in very broad terms, basically from high areas in the landscape towards low areas like rivers and lakes and wetlands. And we know the general chemistry. There was a very good program in the Groundwater Act in the 1980s. Minnesota Pollution Control Agency did a great job of ambient water quality monitoring. There's been a lot of research in specific areas. And so we know a lot about the natural chemistry, such as arsenic and trace metals in aquifers, as well as major ions. And we know a little bit about the anthropogenic sources of contamination in groundwater. We also know where these general sources are coming from. There was a big program with the Superfund program with the US EPA to locate older landfills, underground storage tanks, the more dispersed contamination on the land surface, fertilizers, pesticides, volatile organic compounds. More recently, pharmaceutical compounds are starting to show up in surface waters and pathogens. And general susceptibility aquifer types to land surface contamination. We know a fair bit about where the most susceptible, where these things have been mapped in great detail. We know where the more sensitive aquifer settings are, like sand plains, sand aquifers where the soils are sandy, and in carbonate areas like the karst areas of southeastern Minnesota. Well, we don't just sit back and rest on our laurels. There's also emerging knowledge. And these things develop as we get more information, like good well information, driller's logs, as well as technologies to do our exploration of the underground waters of Minnesota. We've been able to find trace concentrations of waste products and pesticides and VOCs in groundwater. That's emerging. Persistence of degraded contaminants in groundwater, particularly certain pesticides, we're finding out, not the parent pesticide, but some of the degradation products last a long time in groundwater. There's been recent research of some of these things that normally only lasted months to weeks in the atmosphere or on the land surface will persist for long periods of time in terms of years in underground waters. Is there a question?
Yes, if you could, Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just have a question regarding the recent knowledge of some of the chemicals in the Oakdale and Woodbury site. Is your group involved at all with that, with the PFOAs? And how do you, if you're involved, how are you involved? And how do you work with the public as far as education in that regard?
Yeah, that's really an emerging issue. There's certainly a lot of members, particularly in the Minnesota Department of Health, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, of our organization are probably working night and day on this issue as it emerges. Specifically, I don't have personal knowledge about that. I'm not sure if Dale does, but one of the things that I was going to address is very trace levels of contaminants that make it to the water table or to the groundwater will be moved around considerably by high-capacity wells like happens in the metro area where we have a lot of pumping of groundwater. So what started out as maybe a very small source gets spread out in these large aquifers. To answer your question, I was going to get down to it, but later on, one of the tough issues that we don't deal with too well in the Groundwater Association is figuring out what these compounds mean at trace levels to chronic as well as acute health. That's a huge long-term research issue with folks like EPA and their research branches trying to figure out what these things mean, because as we find them, it takes a long time to figure out what it means in terms of health. Did I answer your question? Okay, I'll keep moving here since we only have a few minutes. So that's one. A general recharge and age of groundwater, that's evolving. We're starting to learn how to look at that at least in a large-scale basis, in a regional sense, and I'll show you an example of that, as well as there's some tools to find out how old groundwater is. And that's been a big education process from our profession's standpoint, to educate people that some of the water that they drink is hundreds of years old. And so a contamination that might have started in the 40s is now starting to show up in some of our waters, as an example. aquifer complexities in karst environments. This state is one of the leaders in looking at how solution cavities and fractures that turn into solution cavities in carbonate rocks or dolomites in southeastern Minnesota, with the work of the University of Minnesota and many of the state agencies, is looking at how these waters really don't move the way conventional water moves in underground systems like sands and gravels. And so we have a bit of a handle on that, but it's a long way to go. Hydraulic connections between surface and groundwaters. Another leading activity of this state, you know, from our perspective, is that we are beginning to make that connection to the public. We already knew it as professional practitioners that there's a strong connection between lakes, rivers, wetlands, and our groundwater systems. And then finally, groundwater travel times, because of these other issues that we're working on, as practitioners, we're finding more information that helps people put in context how contaminants move in the groundwater. What's missing? Well, this is easy. This could be a lot longer list, but we try to hone it down to something that might be of interest to this committee. Aquifer materials and boundaries in many specific locations in Minnesota are still unknown. Data is very limited, such as drill hole information in the northwestern and southwestern parts of the state, and it would be very expensive to enhance this over time. And so really the bulletproof way of knowing where these things are is with exploratory drilling or with the existence of well logs from water wells drilled for people. Hydraulic properties of aquifers and confining units. I'm going to try to explain that a little bit better later. But basically, these are units that you do not get water out of if you put a well in it, but they're extremely important because they leak water from aquifer to aquifer. And when you start stressing and doing excessive groundwater withdrawals, which is the next point, those behaviors are not well known, but they're extremely important to understand if you're going to project the effects of excessive pumping on nearby groundwater resources as well as surface water resources. The effects of urbanization is kind of emerging, and there's been some attempts to look at how pavement percent and urbanization in general, suburbanization, has an effect on recharge and the quality of groundwater. That's fairly new and needs some effort. The effects of climate change on groundwater storage. That's a tough nut to crack, but I think it's something that is of state and federal responsibility to help researchers try to establish that so they can understand the more local human effects on groundwater storage. They have to superimpose that stress on top of the climate change effects. And then finally on this list, the toxicity, I just explained that with the Washington County. We really don't know about a lot of the human exposure of trace levels of organic compounds, anthropogenic, in drinking water. We know a little bit about some, but every time we discover a new one, that just gets added to the bottom of the list to be looking at in terms of human health effects. Okay, so we're trying to summarize this then for this group and hopefully instill some questions from this group. What I did here is we tried to be very generic and not talk about any specific problem, but if you want to talk about a specific problem, we can add it to this list. But basically, you throw any contaminant problem or any water supply problem at Minnesota groundwaters, and the first thing that a practitioner will want to look at is on the left-hand column, the what. And if that information isn't available, it makes the job harder to understand how to proceed in terms of prevention or management of a problem. So, number one, define the physical boundaries of the aquifer in three dimensions, and the materials of the aquifers and of the confining units. And we've already talked about there's been some great work done in the metropolitan area. There's going to be some enhancements to that work because the issues, frankly, have been driving this. It hasn't been as systematic as some of us would have liked to see across the state. And so what usually drives this is a problem. And some sort of contamination problem or water use problem usually drives the mapping. And so how would we approach that? I guess we would make a recommendation that there'd be some sort of state acceleration of the geologic atlases, and particularly in the high water use or places where state agencies are seeing the stresses forthcoming in the near future. Number two, define the hydraulic properties. And I want to explain fairly clearly that the complexity and the cost goes up as you go down this list. Okay, and so we try to list it in a way of most useful for a lot of people as well as to do it. Define hydraulic properties, hydraulic boundaries. It's one thing to know the physical boundaries, but the way they behave when you start stressing the aquifer and understand how the water leaks through clays and rock materials that aren't as prolific as sands and sandstones and limestones, it's important to understand that. The movement of storage water, and again, the climate effects are superimposed on that. If you don't understand that while you're working in the now, you might miss the boat in terms of understanding what's going on. What's some basic things we could do to solve that big gap in information? Water level monitoring. We have a water level monitoring program through the Department of Natural Resources. Some federal agencies have a little bit of that, but it's not comprehensive. And I think just some simple looking at grabbing water levels, which help us understand how much is stored in the underground systems, would be beneficial. Low flow in streams, age dating, aquifer tests, mathematical models of a problem that already exists. All these things are kind of more site-specific, but they really add to the body of knowledge, and some of that information is transferable to other areas where a problem hasn't developed yet.
When you're talking, excuse me for a second, but on your water level monitoring, give us some sort of context here about how much we have now and how much you think we need.
Okay, I can give it a specific example. Where I'm familiar with an activity right now that the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources is and the Metropolitan Council is looking at in the metropolitan area. There's been some work in the past every 10 years to take a snapshot of water levels in low pumping times, like in the winter, and high stress times, like in the summer, when irrigation is high and so forth. And looking at a snapshot of how the water levels look in all the aquifers stacked up, and I'm sure there's going to be better presentations later on today from DNR on what you mean by stacked up, but there's a huge groundwater basin underneath us. And one of the best ways to understand how it's responding to the current aquifer use, water supply mostly, is to look at the water levels. And so what's being proposed right now is to look at this right in the next year or two. That should be a routine thing. And instead, what happens is we gen up and look, scratch and scrape for dollars wherever we can find them to do these kind of things. So that's an example. If you want to spread that out to the whole state, there are probably real logistic ways of doing that efficiently. Did I answer your question? Okay. Finally, define the stress. Well, that's usually pumping or contaminant effects on groundwater. And what is that stress going to do, not only to the groundwater itself, but what the groundwater affects? And that's the big question and the big social economic knot that happens when you start talking about sustainability. Because if you do believe, and we do, that groundwater is connected to surface water, what you do in the groundwater eventually will sneak up on you and affect some surface water or some aquatic environment. And so that's why this is not so simple. And we'll talk a little bit about why sustainability is a tough nut to crack, but there are ways maybe to start to approach it. Again, defining the aquifers, maybe there could be some creative partnership incentives for people that want to develop areas of economics in Minnesota that relate to the water use. And put a little more effort into pre-planning. What's this going to look like 10 years from now, 20 years from now? Groundwater reacts very slowly to an impact, but when it does, it takes a long time to recover. So some creative thinking, long-term thinking, technology to education. We think that it would be a really great idea to add a little bit of curriculum to the K-12. Just educating the citizens of the state where about more than half of their water comes from in terms of drinking water. And there's probably a little bit of that sporadically, but it'd be an interesting long-term goal, I think, to start educating people about the hidden resource in Minnesota. Let's move on. I see that rolled off the page. Let me show you a couple of examples of what we mean. This is an example of detailed geologic mapping of aquifers standing in northwestern Minnesota. And if I can point, I don't know if I have an arrow here. Let me point a little bit. This is Fargo Moorhead. What we're looking at is kind of an airplane view of North Dakota and Minnesota looking towards the northeast. Okay, So we're looking across from Fargo, Moorhead. This is the Red River of the North, which divides North Dakota, Minnesota, I-94. And here's some of the hills, the moraines, and the flat areas of the glacial Lake Agassiz that was left behind. And the question is, well, if we had a 1930s drought, what's Fargo and Moorhead going to do for water supply? Certainly the river won't support that. And so there's all kinds of options looked at, including tapping Lake of the Woods and looking at groundwaters in Minnesota. And so this project was actually supported by the federal government to take a closer look. The Minnesota Geological Survey and BNI went in and did a reassessment of the well records to look at aquifers underneath as one of the options maybe to support. Already, Moorhead, you probably were very familiar, has been using this pretty well mapped aquifer called the Buffalo, the pink aquifer. All those other shaded areas really weren't too well mapped out. There was sporadic wells and people knew that there was groundwater under there, but it hadn't really been defined. And with this project, the Minnesota Geological Survey and DNR were able to extend this. They actually worked with the North Dakota Water Commission to do the North Dakota side and start looking at how these aquifers exist. Some of these darn things don't pay much attention to political boundaries, and that's kind of important when you start worrying about managing water resources in a non-political way. And so this is an example of some of the complexities. We wanted to show this example because it's kind of regional in scale, but yet it shows how, at least the public, it shows how complicated glacial aquifers are in Minnesota and North Dakota. Any questions on that? Okay, I'll bring you back full circle. Think about the lake analogy I started out with. This is just a typical, very, very simple cross-section of what we call superficial sand and gravel aquifer that's typical in Minnesota. It could be a lake. Take your favorite lake and fill it with sand and gravel. And now you have a little bit more complex system to deal with, because that sand and gravel, and throw a little couple layers of clay in there, really affects how the water replenishes that system, that resource, how the water moves through it, how contaminants move through it, where they exit the system, okay, like in streams. And then these confining units. Well, we always draw these cartoons to show that they're continuously exist underneath these aquifers. In reality, there's holes in them, and there's leakage to those. Well, you don't always know where those are. And that's where the very specific geologic mapping and ATLAS program has been extremely beneficial when a problem does crop up. And I use that word loosely, but this diagram, we show corn as one of the potential sources. But you could put a landfill there, a septic tank, or stormwater system that's leaking in urban areas. And so what I'm trying to convey here is that basic understanding of what you're dealing with in the physical framework is fundamental, and that's something that's probably a good role for a state like Minnesota to get involved in. Sorry that the rest of this isn't showing up. And lastly, I want to leave you with this. We are making, as a kind of an emerging knowledge, making some progress on looking at groundwater recharge across the nation as well as in Minnesota. And this particular exercise here is to look at ways to estimate regional recharge for the whole state of Minnesota. And it's looking, and it's a works in progress. I want to make it very clear. It's a statewide scale effort. This was done with the USGS and Minnesota Department of Natural Resources to look at basic hydrologic principles of precipitation that falls on the ground, evaporation, soil texture. This would be a much better map if we had excellent maps throughout the state of where our aquifers are. But this is a first cut to use our soils information to look at this. And we would not expect anybody in any particular county to go here and say, well, my recharge is X based on this map. But it does give you a flavor on a regional basis that the recharge isn't all that high in the west, and it's pretty high in the Arrowhead, potentially. And so it kind of gives you a perspective. And what some folks are doing is starting with these maps and starting to talk about sustainable groundwater supply or reusable groundwater supply. It's a first cut. There's a long way to go. And if you go back to the diagram where I showed you the detailed need for information at in a smaller scale or a higher resolution, such as that cross section, that's where you really find out how sustainable the groundwater is in any particular location.
Excuse me, let me ask a question here. It's like I'm seeing this map for the first time. I mean, we get to see it last night, but it was in black and white, so I couldn't figure out really what was going on. I was just at a presentation on wetlands where someone from was talking about what would happen in climate change as you get drier in the Dakotas, and how we would be losing our wetlands. Do you, all the way at, we're specifically talking about how the ducks would move more and more east and then just kind of die out because we were losing our wetlands. They were looking at the areas that you have in brown. What are you all thinking about when you're thinking about climate change and giving us advice?
That's a good question. To repeat, what do we think about when we think about climate change? We think about long-term hydrologic information, which is, I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to mention, this is like selling life insurance. Most people don't understand what the value is while they're paying for it, but in the long-term hydrologic information really helps us understand where we are in the climate cycle. Most of us practitioners in groundwater are geology types, and we think in very long-term frames, and it's really part of the big debate in what is climate change. Are we seeing anything, or is it really natural? And you can't really get at the rates of climate change without long-term hydrologic information. We've been very fortunate in this state and other states to have a long-term program in stream flow, and stream flow is a very good indicator of what's going on climate-wise, and there's been some really good recent research in showing how climate change is affecting spring runoff and so forth. We don't have that kind of data set in many areas for groundwater. And groundwater just behaves much slower than surface water, of course. But it is important. When you drop that storage in groundwater, you can have long-term effects. And I have one example. When I first came back to the state in the early 80s, we were just finishing a research project in Moraine Lake in Washington County, I believe it was, and people could not figure out why during a drought the water levels were coming up in that lake. It was related to the groundwater. The groundwater was actually replenishing from an older period of time and actually affecting the lake levels when there was, in fact, a drought going on and the wetlands surrounding it were drying up. So it is important. We have a long way to go, and that's why I kind of profess that a good network of water level monitoring would help us along that line.
Representative Ansel has a question.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. The last slice in the graphing, the white area described as unclassifiable.
Yeah.
Significant, short term, long term.
Yeah. The unclassifiable, that's a major area of our peatlands, and it was hard to classify how those soils behave hydraulically. That's why. Yeah, good question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think if we look at the long-term records of rainfall, do you study any of that? And could you describe some of that map you had just up? Generally, as I understand it, you have higher incidence of you have more annual precipitation as you go east in the state and then go west, and especially get into the Dakotas, and when the pioneers settled the land, it was basically a line that was less than 20 inches of precipitation a year in annual rainfall, and they thought you couldn't grow crops out in that area, and basically kept a lot of the Dakotas from being settled. And what my question is, in a historical basis, and you look back, say, even the last 20 years maybe, what has been done with the how do you see the annual rainfall, annual precipitation levels going?
Yeah, that's a good question. It adds to the complexity of how climate really behaves. We really are coming off some of the wettest period on record in this part of the world. And so you're really confounded by what's going on in other parts of the country. But in that part of the world, as you probably well know, there's been significant floods in the Red River Basin, and water levels, the soil moisture is way up in that part of the world. That's not going to last. If we believe the cycles we've seen in history, that's why folks like the Bureau of Reclamation are being asked to look at water supply in a drought. And so someone asked, well, what's a drought? Well, people remember the 30s drought, or some of their family members or generations remember that. So they were pretty clever, I think, to pick that. It definitely wasn't the driest period in any kind of record, but it was memorable, and it's probably a good base. So that's one way to look at these things, is what's happened in fairly recent history.
Well, Madam Chair, I live on the South Dakota border out there, and especially the northwest quarter of South Dakota, a lot of folks think that the climate changed out there because of the damming up of the Missouri River, and when they were getting snowfall out in Montana and North Dakota and Wyoming, and actually getting higher levels of water out in the Missouri River as this weather systems came through from the west. We had tremendous flooding out in the northwest portion of South Dakota and into Minnesota, and I remember 1993 very well, because most of us farmers disc up our crops because we couldn't get in the fields, and it was so wet. But I you know, I don't know if the South Dakota folks are right, if the man-made actions of man by flooding up the river has indeed changed the climate there for a long term. It certainly has. I don't think there's any disputing. It certainly has for the past many years. And a saying we have in the farm is, it takes a long time to get dry, but you can get wet overnight. And the grain markets certainly know that. But would you comment on that?
I probably cannot have authority to comment on that. It's within a natural cycle, so I can't answer that, whether it's from human effects of reservoir development. I hadn't heard that one, but that doesn't mean it's not a possibility. Those kinds of wet and dry cycles have been found historically, and they're not nationwide; they're regional.
Any other questions, members?
We figured that recharge and sustainability, and the use of recharge to look at sustainability, might be of interest to this group. And so just to remind you and kind of give a promotional to our organization, we do have regular conferences, and our spring conference in the afternoon is going to talk about it. We'd love to have any representatives or your staffers come and join us and get into the nitty-gritty, because it will be a discussion. We don't have all the answers on that one.
Well, I, for one, appreciate the invitation. I went to one of your conferences about 3 or 4 years ago and learned about all the arsenic in the ground in western Minnesota that appears naturally, and was astonished and came home and had our well tested because of that. And indeed, there was arsenic in the well. And when I asked the folks who did the well testing, and this was in Alexandria, they said no one had ever asked to have arsenic tested. And this was a general purpose lab that everybody in the area used. Mm-hmm. Is information like that getting out to folks now? Well, this was maybe 3 or 4 years ago when you had the presentation. Is it getting out to folks so they know to test their wells?
I think the information is available through the computer networks now. Some of the databases are posted, such as in the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Our organization tries to get the word out. I can't answer how well that word's getting out in terms of people's education and testing their own waters. You have a perspective on that? He was the president when that happened.
It's just the kind of thing that that doesn't draw a crowd. If I said I'm going to have a conference and talk about geology and arsenic, people won't be pounding down the door to get in. And so, you know, maybe the best you can hope for is Minnesota Groundwater Association hosts children's water festivals, and we get to them when they're young and try to get them to understand the fundamentals of groundwater. It's really not part of the school curriculum yet. When I go to a school and do a talk, I walk to the back of the room. There's usually a sink. I turn it on and I say, where's that water coming from? Very often, no one in the room has a clue. And if you look out the window, you can see the well. It's there's that lack of awareness of where it all comes from, or that it's just stored rainwater. So the fundamentals is the best place to start, and then these other things fall into place after that.
Yes, Representative Hanson has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that point, you know, 20 years ago, there were conferences, I remember, at the old St. Paul Radisson, where 200 or 300 or 400 people would show up to talk about groundwater, and they were sponsored by the Freshwater Foundation. And shortly after that, the legislature passed the Groundwater Protection Act. And, you know, recently it seems we're spending a lot of time on surface water with the TMDL process, and groundwater has kind of moved into the background. And I just like your observations on that a little bit, because we're approaching 20 years since we passed the Groundwater Protection Act, and that was the result of a lot of emphasis and a lot of effort and a lot of dollars and fees going into, you know, just where are we now? Do we need to revisit that? Or I like your thoughts on that.
Yeah, thanks for that leading question. That's we were hoping for a question like that. We made a lot of progress during that Groundwater Protection Act as professionals and academia and so forth, trying to advance the information and understanding of groundwater in Minnesota. And that's the kind of thing we think this state deserves again. From our perspective, I'm a native of this state, and I feel that the emphasis we are putting on groundwater now has been slipping to surface water, and there's a good reason for that. When you start looking at contamination and exotic emerging contaminants, that's the first place you look. If you see a problem in surface water, then you ask the question: is it in groundwater? But fundamentally, now we're dealing with two issues. One is a water-rich state like this is starting to bump up against the stress envelope, and a perfect example is the development up towards St. Cloud. We're moving our population in this metro area in an area where the aquifers aren't that prolific, and we're going to see some problems up there. There's going to be some arguments of do we use the surface water before Minneapolis gets it and St. Paul gets it, or do we tap into the groundwater? Where is the groundwater? And so I think it's high time, from our perspective as an organization, the Minnesota Groundwater Association, to reinvest in Minnesota's groundwater through something like the Groundwater Act.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was wondering if your organization is doing any work and what kind of work you're doing, thinking about some of the new energy sources we're using, particularly ethanol and biofuels, and how you see that impacting the groundwater.
Yeah, thank you for that question, Representative. I guess that's what I meant by throw any problem. I was trying to be generic, but that obviously is an emerging issue. There's talk about using lots of water to develop these products, and it's a great idea to look at other energy alternatives. And all we're suggesting is if groundwater is part of that equation, let's do a lot of planning. Let's not put plants where there isn't the groundwater. And some of these plants are being sited in areas where we don't know much about the groundwater, like in western Minnesota.
Yes,
Thank you, Chair Regis. I come from a suburb where we have a guy, every time there's a development project, gives his groundwater infiltration speech, I guess. We talk about curb and gutter and stormwater ponds, and he says, well, let's make sure we recharge the aquifer. But it led me to ask another question. We have stormwater ponds all over the place in urban areas and the Target parking lots, the grocery store parking lots. Any new development has to have a retention area to be able to slow down the surge of runoff, which is good for the surface waters, but they also happen to be these slowly filling areas where the sediments at the bottom have got salt, sand, motor oil, transmission fluid, all sorts of other stuff. And they're not, you know, you don't have a liner like you have in a municipal solid waste landfill, for example. Are we going to have, in trying to solve one problem, hundreds of thousands of ponds with this stuff in it that's, who knows what's going to happen to it? Is it going to dry out into the air? Is it going to go into the groundwater? Is it just going to stay there? Is this something we should think about?
Yes.
Okay.
The Metropolitan Council has thought about it, and they've done a little bit of research looking at some simple things like dissolved minerals and nutrients coming through these rain gardens, as an example. But there's a lot unknown. I mean, the whole idea, replenishing the groundwater recharge, that's a great idea. But I'm not sure many people are looking and or doing the research to look at what's leaking through the bottom of these things. The theory is good that the plants will uptake a lot of this and the mud. The other question is, how do you maintain them? They're going to fill up with muck and things like that, and there's not been a great deal of talk about that. But they do look good, and they solve the problem that you're talking about on the surface water side. But it's one of those emerging issues that's pretty specific to the urban area.
Just as a follow-up, Chair Gaines, I worked in a municipal solid waste area, and any place that's contaminated, where the soil's contaminated, like petroleum sites or leaking fuel tanks, all that soil that gets dug up goes to an industrial waste landfill, so then we have to deal with it there. So I'm just suggesting that prevention is always cheaper. So if we can, I don't know how we're going to catch every drop of motor oil in the future. I don't think we will, but it's making me think of incentives and research and so on to help us figure out that problem. I'm not meaning to create a new crisis or anything, but it's weighing on my mind.
I can see that, and I'm sitting here thinking about people who want to sell these as functioning wetlands, and what I hear from you is that I should not buy that argument.
Well, all I'm saying is there's not a body of information on the chemistry side of these things yet.
Mm-hmm.
It's, again, it was a great idea, and someone's starting to ask the right questions. Well, what about the quality of the water that's coming through them? So I can't say right now if they're going to work or not.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stoner, your comment just a few minutes ago about the growth in the St. Cloud area and the lack of water resources. I've been hearing about this for the last couple of years, and I'm wondering if you know of any organized effort or any group who is looking at those issues specifically?
I'll let Dale help me with this one, but there was a group that tried to develop a project proposal for that area. Metropolitan Council was interested, but that's beyond their jurisdiction. And I think we're still working through that one. But I think there's a lot of interest, certainly. I mean, you finish the big train ride up there, it's not going to get any better in terms of the population growth. So I think it is a real issue that we're trying to educate folks that some of the major aquifers that are available to us here in the metro area don't exist up there.
Representative Kingston, in your packet, I put a letter actually to you from Commissioner Mandernach from the Health Department, and this was, I guess it wasn't to you, it was at your request to the LCCMR, and I think it does talk about the St. Cloud area that we at this time have no plans at the state level for surface water protection that's going to be used for drinking water. And St. Cloud is obviously the perfect example, and it's something that I think we all are going to have to discuss, and that's why I put that in the packet. I know from just Minneapolis's point of view, and I'm a Minneapolis resident, in order to use the Mississippi River, and it's a good thing we do, because if we use the aquifer, I think it would disappear quite quickly. It is enormously expensive, particularly with the emerging contaminants, because the surface that feeds the Mississippi is not protected. So if we're going to be imposing that same standard on any other community, which they will have to do, of having enormously expensive drinking water system, it is something I think maybe we should take a longer term look at, maybe over the interim or LCC law. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, if I could add something. In terms of gathering the information we need in that particular area, I'm aware that the Division of Waters at DNR is enhancing the mapping in the eastern part of Stearns County. And as you may be aware, there is an LCCMR project to accelerate geologic atlases, and I'm in discussion with Benton County to see if they want to participate in that county. We definitely need to get into Wright County and Sherburne County and get the mapping done in those areas as well, and hopefully that will happen before too long.
Well, I don't see any more questions. I appreciate your coming and getting us started on thinking about something we're going to have to spend some more time on as we go along.
Well, thanks for the invitation, and if you need to contact us, we're available.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Continuing right along, we're now going from the general to the specific, and we appreciate our Kent Lacasmo doing a primer from the DNR because they are in charge of our groundwater.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Kent Lacasmo, the Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. And I appreciate this opportunity to discuss groundwater. As we all know, Minnesota's water rich, but the resource is not evenly distributed across the state, as you heard some of in the previous discussion. We work cooperatively with the Groundwater Association. Many of our staff are members of that association, and it's a large undertaking. Today, I'm going to quickly go through groundwater availability, our expected outcomes, management options, which are permits, conservation, consumptive use, pricing, and then some of the challenges that exist. This map shows the availability of groundwater for high-capacity uses across the state. The green area in the southeast is where we have multiple regional aquifers. There's a pretty decent supply of water. But it can be limited in certain cases where you have contamination or you have other types of conflicts. The brown area of the state is the area where groundwater is limited. It's available only in isolated aquifers. So we have that range across the state. Yeah, the blue area is generally there's groundwater available from the near surface glacial sands. In the Twin Cities area, you heard mention of this in the previous discussion about the aquifers in the metro area. This is the western Twin Cities area, like Medina vicinity. And the yellow are the water table shallow aquifers. When you get down to St. Lawrence Franconia, that's Ironton-Galesville, that's a combined aquifer. And then the deepest one, the Mount Simon aquifer. If you look at what you notice here is that we don't have the Prairie du Chien aquifer identified. That's the aquifer that is generally under the Twin Cities and is the workhorse aquifer for most of the metro area. That's where most get their water supply. And the Mount Simon is underlying that. If you went outside here and drilled a well, you'd go through the Jordan, you'd get to the Mount Simon. As you go west, that Jordan is not there, and you're left with these, and they eventually, as you go further west, they also run out. This is a slide that some of you may have seen already. We had, actually the next three, I think, were part of an LCCMR request that we made to define aquifers. That was not fun. But what this shows here in the yellow and the blue areas are defined aquifers, the aquifers where we've already done some work and we've identified in southwestern
Excuse me for interrupting. A question here from Representative.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just would like to point out to the committee that there'll be a bill coming forward later this session. Representative Peterson's carrying it this year, and I've carried it in the past about the Lewis and Clark Water Project that is a project that affects the area you see shaded in the tan here. Basically the Missouri River watershed, and we'll be coming forth before the committee to talk about that water project again. It's a project to pipe water out of the Missouri River near Vermilion, South Dakota, and pipe it up into Sioux Falls area of South Dakota and into southwest Minnesota and then down into northwest Iowa, because we're all facing the same problem there. Rock County is the only county in the state without a lake, and this tan-shaded area is a real problem. So I appreciate, Madam Chair, the chance to talk a little bit about that.
Madam Chair, just a quick response. Initially, that project was designed to deliver water to a much larger area, but we have concerns over interbasin transfer of water, so the project now is limited to delivery of Missouri River water to the Missouri River Basin. And the brown on this map is only the delineates that watershed. It's not showing any aquifers. So this shows the three major aquifers. There may be other aquifers of large size out here, but we don't know. There hasn't been investigation to document that. This is a map of aquifers found near Granite Falls, and that general area. This is part of a regional assessment project, and this shows the different colors show different levels of aquifers. And this, just, you know, this process cost about $500,000, took 4 years to do. These are not inexpensive projects. The next shows the Fargo-Moorhead region, and you saw some of this in the last presentation. The Buffalo Aquifer, which is the...
Can you excuse me for... We are going to take questions as we go along, because I just think that's helpful. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Mr. Loxamo, you have major aquifers identified in southwest Minnesota on a previous slide. Considering what Representative Magnus said, in the extent of the rural water system in southwest Minnesota, I mean, they're drawing water out of the ground in western Yellow Medicine County in the what you might call the Buffalo Ridge or the Coteau Hills. It's significant amounts, and, you know, in some parts of Lincoln County, depth of the groundwater is only like 5 feet, and they have wellhead protection zones. I'm just wondering why these... what I would maybe refer to as aquifers are not being shown on the map when there's extensive pumping for many, many years coming out of these hills in western Yellow Medicine County. And the head drop, the Marshall is so great, they have reliever valves and delivery of rural water. I'm just wondering, is it not coming from an aquifer? And it's in Minnesota, so I'm wondering why it's not identified. It's been being pumped and infrastructure's been out there for years.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, this map is not intended to show all aquifers that exist out here. These were the, you know, three of the major aquifers that we identified in as, you know, just presentation material. There are other smaller aquifers, and there may be other major aquifers that are that exist here that we don't have enough information to accurately delineate them and show them on a map. We were talking about the Moorhead Aquifer earlier, Buffalo Aquifer at Moorhead. And Moorhead used to use that for its principal water supply. They have switched to surface water, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But this, the Buffalo Aquifer, there's been a lot of study on that. We probably spent $2 million between various levels of government over the last 10 to 20 years. The other aquifer that's closer to the state line, shown in brown, is a potentially new aquifer identified, but it is an aquifer. And we just identified generally that outline, but we really need to define that further. And that would take exploratory drilling, pumping tests, and monitoring. And I know Moorhead's talking about that. That's about $250,000 to further that study on that specific aquifer. And additionally, if you look at northeastern Minnesota, you have mine pits. They're basically being filled with groundwater if they're not maintained and pumped. And water supply for municipalities or processing power production are all groundwater related in northeastern Minnesota. Then you have the central sands area, which is typically used for irrigation. Water use information. What this chart shows, the surface water is the blue, and the white is groundwater use. So power generation, which is mostly cooling water. The public supply is split between both surface and groundwater. And the big, you have the big four cities, I guess, that rely on surface water: Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, and St. Cloud. Generally, the rest of the state is groundwater. And you'd note that irrigation is 85% groundwater. These two maps just show where irrigation permits are on the left chart and how they're distributed across the state. And then on the right chart shows the public water supply permit location. And the whatever purple colored dots are trout streams or calcarea slip fins, which are sensitive resources that could be impacted by groundwater withdrawal. This chart shows public water supply, and population is the blue line. And so, as you'd expect, as population increases, the public supply increases. And you see fluctuations based on the climate conditions on a shorter-term basis. When it's hot and dry, there's more water use, and water use in the summer is significantly higher due to lawn watering. Our water management options that we have and that Minnesotans should expect is to balance, that we balance resource development and protection, and the statutory sites is there, that there is efficient use of the water for critical resource protection and future needs. There's adequate information for resource decisions, that we do water supply planning for future needs. There's development of aquifer management plans, and reduction in use of heritage water. What's meant by heritage water is old water. We do, as we do county atlases, we do testing for the age of water, and a tritium test costs about $150 per sample. If you do carbon-14, it's about $500 per sample. But we do that, and the age of water around the state is from very, very recent and new water to water up to 10,000 years old, and it varies by aquifer and it varies by location. There's been a lot of discussion about sustainability, and we did a report a couple years ago that kind of refined with all of our partners what an acceptable term or definition of sustainability would be, which is the use of water to provide for the needs of society now and in the future without unacceptable social, economic, or environmental consequences. The tools to manage water supply are to deal with water supply conflicts when demands exceed the supply. And there are well interferences. We have a slide here that will show how that happens. And typically those are short-lived, and because they typically happen with the irrigation high-capacity wells, and that's a seasonal use. If you're looking at a high-capacity year-round use, it could be it wouldn't necessarily be a temporary impact. Deal with resource protection limits. Looking at a safe yield for groundwater. Groundwater is recharged by surface water, and the question is what's...
Excuse me, we're going to take another question. Representative Anto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go back to the slide with that wonderful feel-good sentence there? Use of water to provide for the needs of society now and in the future without unacceptable social, economic, or environmental consequences. That strikes me as a noble goal, but I'd like to know a little bit more about how, who, and because I represent a fragile area in northern Minnesota of mining and various and assorted other industrial kinds of concerns, can the people really be assured that water in versus water out is okay, and in the industrial uses of the aquifer and the people's water, that in the permitting process and in the application and use of this resource, that resource is just as good when it leaves the process as it was when it went in?
Madam Chair, Representative, one way to look at that is that in Minnesota, we are the headwaters of three major watersheds. We don't have water flowing into the state. We have the Great Lakes, the St. Lawrence, Seaway, Hudson Bay, and the Mississippi River. And so the water that we have falls on the state. And that water recharges groundwater. And so what we have is what we, you know, what falls on the state is what we have. And we aren't relying on, outside sources. So what we have to make sure that we do is adequately manage what we have. So that's when we say the reduction in the use of heritage water. There was legislation passed in 1989, the Groundwater Act, that dealt with that issue in a degree for the metropolitan area, that the Mount Simon Hinckley, the deepest aquifer, is kind of held in reserve for future uses. It's the savings account for water. But are we going to, there will be some impact. When you're withdrawing water, and you can look at how readily the aquifer replenishes. I mean, the one thing that we need is data and monitoring to be able to track those issues. What Jeff Stoner mentioned, I do have that on a slide later, about the mass water level measurements for the metropolitan area. I mean, last done in 1990, and we're about to do that again. That's a good picture, so you can see. So you can look at an individual hydrograph and see a decline, and you'll see declines and seasonal declines. But generally, aquifers will show a decline over time. But whether or not that, what percentage of decline is that? We put protections on permits to limit the amount of use, and there are ways to deal with conflict. Is it, there's going to be some impact, but we need the data, information, and regulatory system to manage that impact.
Yes, Representative Adams.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a brief response to a follow-up question. That was a great answer. But I need to feel better about the department's ability to compile the data and do the monitoring. Are we sufficiently capable, considering all that goes on in northern Minnesota? Are we able to compile the data and do the monitoring?
Madam Chair, Representative Anthony. We are capable. Are we funded adequately to do that? And we don't have as comprehensive a system for groundwater monitoring as would be desirable. Because we don't have observation wells in each aquifer in each county, so it's not it's not a total picture. We are where we anticipate impacts. We put resources at those impacts. You'll see I have comments later that we're really funded to be more reactive than proactive, and that's that's a challenge then for dealing with the questions that you raise.
That when you say you're funded more to be reactive than proactive, one of the things that I'm trying to understand our responsibilities toward groundwater, I looked at the commissioner's authority, and there's supposed to be a water conservation program for the state that includes conservation and allocation and development of the waters for the best interest of the people. Do we have that plan, or is that something we still need to develop?
Madam Chair, we have a plan. And basically what's happened now is since we're right now in the process of redoing the second generation emergency and conservation plans for municipal use. So those plans are being developed. The is there a document that is a state conservation plan? No.
My question is, since that is statutory and I look at what the Commissioner of Health has stated to us, which I thought was pretty kind of, okay, y'all get going kind of letter, that this needs to be a discussion that we have, maybe not in this week, but over the summer. Is that something that we should be thinking about?
Madam Chair, yes. And I'd like to have Jim Jaff respond to the last question.
Madam Chair, if I could respond. For the record, my name is Jim Jaff. I'm the Assistant Director for the DNR Division of Waters. As far as the conservation plan component that you talked about, that element of the statute we are implementing with every permit we issue, because conservation is required for every user that we have, whether it's public water supply and required to have a water emergency and conservation plan, or whether it's an irrigation permit, which is required to get a soil and water conservation plan from the soil and water conservation district. So that is a required element for all of our permits, and that's how we are implementing it.
Excuse me, Representative Scalzi has a question.
Not to that point.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Kent Lacosmo, I represent an area about 7 miles north of here in Badness Heights. We have a company called H.B. Fuller, and I'm not sure if you're aware of their discharge facility and how they use the groundwater and the surface water, but to my knowledge, this has been going on for probably 20 years, and I think they were probably installed in that facility before it became illegal to use groundwater and discharge it on the surface. But I just received recently from the PCA a public notice, because they're going to reissue this permit for another 5 years, and I'm assuming that this goes on every 5 years, but they discharge 1.5 million gallons a day. And so when you talk about well interference and how it may be for crop irrigation, et cetera, this has been going on for some time, and I don't know what the DNR's position is on this. If there would be, I mean, their grandfather, but I'm sure that at one point, my house has a well, so I've always been concerned about this, and I'm assuming that after 20 years, if my well hasn't run dry yet, I'm probably going to be okay, but I'm wondering what the future is. This is just north of here where a lot of cities are getting their groundwater from, and what would be the future, and how would the DNR react with the PCA in relationship to this H.B. Fuller permit process?
Madam Chair, Representative Scully. In 1989, the Groundwater Act prohibited use of groundwater for once-through cooling, and it gave existing industries 20 years to convert until 2010. And H.B. Fuller was one of those, so they were under that requirement to convert by the end of the useful life or at the outside by 2010. what happened several years ago, H.B. Fuller came in for an exemption to be exempted from that requirement, and we objected to that. The legislature passed a law that exempted H.B. Fuller from having to convert. So they not only are grandfathered in, they have a specific exemption that allows them to continue. And they do pay a fee for once through cooling has been a higher fee, and that fee recently was raised. So they pay $300 per million gallons of water that they use for once through cooling, versus the municipality would be paying at the high end $7.50 if they're using over 500 million gallons a year. So they, you're right. It's a poor use of groundwater. We thought those should be eliminated, and through the legislative process, they were provided an exemption.
So then, through the legislative process, could the exemption be lifted then? And I'm just wondering how that exemption was worded.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, it could. We could provide you the citation and more history on that if you like.
So then at this point, Mr. Lacasmo, the DNR is out of the picture and totally, because of the exemption, then you're totally out of the picture of the protection of the surface water that's impacted by this 1.5 million gallon a day discharge.
Madam Chair, Representative Public, no, we aren't out of the picture. We still have a permit for their groundwater use, and we still have regulation over the surface water. Discharge permit is a PCA permit, and that's something that's, routine every 5 years, like you say, process. So we have concerns, but the ability to deny the once-through-cooling use has been, our ability to react to that has been eliminated. I mean, it's been grandfathered in or been allowed through legislation.
And do you have an opinion, or does someone have an opinion of the future of this use? Is it something we should be concerned about, or do we just let it go as it is and just forget about it unless somebody's city's well runs dry or my well runs dry or whatever happens, I mean, is it just something, 20 years is a long time, and I'm wondering what your opinion is of the future.
Madam Chair, Representative Sullivan, we do have priority uses in the statutes. So using groundwater to cool, heat and cool is a lower priority use. If there were a conflict, that could be restricted that way. And so what we need to do is continue to monitor and see if there are noticeable impacts.
So are you currently monitoring this use so that we know the establishment and the level of the groundwater? To make somebody like me feel better, because my well is 280 feet deep, and I'm thinking, sooner or later we're going to reach my level because I'm a deep well. And I'm just kind of wondering if you are monitoring it or is anybody monitoring it. I don't know that the PCA is.
Madam Chair, Representative, I know there's some monitoring, and I know H.B. Fuller has monitoring wells. With precisely where they are or in what aquifers, if your well's 280 feet, it's probably in the same aquifer that H.B. Fuller is using, but we'd have to look at that and verify it, and we could provide you more information.
Representative Peterson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And since we're on district-specific examples of water use, I'm wondering if there's desire to reconvene the Minnesota Boundary Waters Commission with South Dakota, and using this example as to why I think that should occur, is that along on the South Dakota border, there's a proposed 600 megawatt expansion of a coal plant called Big Stone 2 that South Dakota has granted that idea the authority, I guess, to draw down annually 3.2 billion gallons of water from Big Stone Lake, which is Minnesota's 10th largest lake, but it's a border lake. Now, 3.2 billion gallons sounds like a lot of water, but we think what we should do is convert that to hydraulic terms and get it into something you can talk about, like it's acre feet. So I calculate that 3.2 billion gallons equates to 9,820 acre-feet per year of drawdown. Over a 13,000-acre lake, which would be about 9 inches of drawdown per, you know, we're talking about 9 inches of drawdown on Big Stone Lake, which I calculate if you assume that Big Stone Lake's average depth is about 10 feet, I think it's 14 to 12 feet deep, the total acre feet is probably 130,000 acre feet. That's just a rough calculation. So that's 7.5% of the lake's volume. I'm wondering what the effect on groundwater might be given this scenario and the loss of in that increase in gradient between that 9 inches at the lake surface versus how much the groundwater table may be drawn down as a result of that gradient change and the blufflands and uplands above the lake. You see what I mean? How the groundwater table might respond to that drawdown. Knowing that on the Minnesota side, there is proposed housing development of about 120 houses sitting out on a bluff that's tracked and ready to go, but there's no houses there yet, which would be a development in Big Stone County for housing and infrastructure that would be paying taxes in Minnesota to help the county of Big Stone, which is a depressed rural county. I would think that using water out of Big Stone Lake for housing development would be a lot less than 3.2 billion acres, billion gallons per year, and would be better served as the use for Minnesota side development, not a blank check to the state of South Dakota for a proposed coal plant that has other environmental issues surrounding it. So I'm wondering if anybody's done the analysis. I know that there's a comment letter you've received as of June 30, 2006 from the Minnesota River Watershed Alliance out of Mankato, and your response to them says that we will be making a formal request soon to convene the Minnesota Boundary Waters Commission with South Dakota. My understanding is that that has not happened yet. So I'm wondering if I think this is a significant issue and that the governors of Minnesota and South Dakota, and I think Governor Plenty needs to assert himself into this conversation with South Dakota on a border water issue that I feel is significant. And from what you're saying here today, water is not as plentiful as Minnesotans assume it is. So that's just more of a comment. I mean, have you done the hydraulic analysis that would, if Big Stone Lake is drawn down 3.2 billion gallons a year, what's the effect during a drought year? What's the loss of lake area? You know, how does this affect rearing of fish and spawning of fish and water quality and flow into the Minnesota River and concentration of pollutants with less water? I mean, has the DNR asked and worked with South Dakota to actually answer some of these questions? I would request that Governor Plenty gets involved.
Madam Chair, Representative Peterson, we are in the process, as you say. We haven't yet requested the Boundary Area Commission meet. We are going to do that. I expect that request will be within a couple weeks. A dispute between states, if we elevate, we objected to the power plant and their use of water without consulting with Minnesota. I know we've had staff looking at the impacts and looking at the, I don't believe we've done any of the groundwater type investigation that you referenced. I mean, we can talk more specifically about that and talk with some of our staff that have been involved and provide you more information. But we haven't done the type of detailed analysis that you're requesting. You know, a dispute between the states gets pretty difficult because if we sue South Dakota, that court of first resort is the U.S. Supreme Court, and I don't know that we want to go there. But we do believe that these border issues should be managed collectively by the states within, you know, the states that have watershed affecting the Minnesota River should collectively manage that. You shouldn't have a state taking unilateral action. So we think the Boundary Water Commission is at least a way to have discussion. South Dakota seems pretty set to move forward on Big Stone too. So whether or not this Boundary Water Commission can have much impact in their decision, I'm not sure. But we do think that's an avenue where the states should have discussion. And as far as the technical details on the impacts, we can provide you more information. Some of the flow is obviously when the lake is outflowing and it's going down the Minnesota River. So the more of the impact, I believe, would be seen in the Minnesota River than in the lake itself. So we'll provide you more detailed information.
Appreciate it. Thanks.
If you want to continue.
We're talking about resource protection limits, and I think we've probably covered that to some degree. This is just a cross-section of the Granite Falls area, and you see the shaded-in areas there where there are aquifers. So there are limited, and the scale as you're going, looking at these squares, they're like 1 mile distance. So the ethanol plant, the proposed ethanol plant, is about 3 miles, 2.5 miles from the Minnesota River. But you can see there are areas there. If you drop the well in, you may not hit water.
Excuse me, does Granite Falls use aquifers for their water, or do they use the river?
Madam Chair, the city of Granite Falls, mm-hmm. I believe they are using aquifers on it.
Madam Chair, until about 1985, thereabouts, they were on the Minnesota River, but because of concerns to upgrade the water treatment plant because of the surface water rules, they did go to a groundwater supply.
Thank you.
Well interference is one of the things that occurs certainly during times of drought when there are stresses to the system. There's a process in the rule to deal with that, and the common solutions are to lower the wells, or even install a new well for the well that's interfered with. This chart shows what happens with well interference. You look at the center, the high volume pumping well is the well that's withdrawing groundwater and creating this cone of depression. The dashed line across the top of that diagram would be the water level before any pumping starts. And then you start pumping with the high capacity, and that draws down the water surface. The domestic well is shown on the left. Then if this high capacity well starts, it ends up being out of water in this diagram. So the solution of that would be to lower that that domestic well down further into the aquifer, so it would have water. And we do have a process. We have well interferences that occur from time to time, and certainly during the drought years in the last significant drought, 88, 89, there were dozens, tens and twenties of them. I mean, it's not hundreds, but there certainly are well interferences that occur. One of the areas where we recently had well interferences occur was in the and around the city of Lakeville. This chart shows in red the daily pumping from the city of Lakeville, and in blue it shows the water elevation in their aquifer. And that's actually from one individual's well. But you'll see in July of 01, they were withdrawing about 20 million gallons a day. And this caused, how many well interferences?
There were roughly about 80 calls that we received. We received about 35 formal well interference complaints that we investigated. But you can see that in the winter water use on the right-hand side of the graph, that their winter water use is in the 3 to 4 million gallon range. And in July of 2001, 4th of July happened to be on a Wednesday, and everybody came home after being away for the holiday and turned on their sprinklers because it had been dry out, and they actually spiked at 20.4 million gallons per day. On their website at the time, they were advertising that they didn't have any sprinkling bans like other communities in the area. Subsequently, they have implemented a number of conservation measures there and definitely support that. But if they had conservation, they could have cut the peak there and maybe prevented some of those interference complaints, most of which we found to be valid.
And we ended up spending several years and through an administrative hearing, since the city contested the well interferences. You know, it was a lot of time and money and effort to resolve this. These three pictures show, and I think you saw some of this with Jeff Stoner's slides, the recharge area. You have an unconfined aquifer, and it's flowing to the right to the stream. You put in a well, and then you see that pumping at a given amount, that's starting to affect the flow of water to the stream or lake or wetland. And then on the bottom diagram, if you pump further or pump harder, you could in fact start drawing water away from the stream or wetland or water resource that's on the right and into the production well. And why does that matter? You know, if there's a trout stream nearby and you decrease water levels or other sensitive habitats, that stresses those systems. This is an observation well near the Sioux Nation Fen in western Minnesota. And it's the calcareous fen, which is fed by upwelling groundwater, so it has calcium-rich water that has unique plants. And what you see here are two thresholds that were set for pumping levels. And you see the change where it bounced from down around the red line up to not exceeding the red line. That was a change that they found alternative sources of water, and they started looking at other or distributing their water use from just the production well that they had at the Burr well field. This chart shows, this is the city of, or the city, this is the Granite Falls ethanol, and the lines at the top show their pumping in the water level. The yellow line, the 50% threshold, is the line that we have. This is in their permit, it's a requirement of their permit, that when their water levels hit this yellow line, they need to modify their pumping. They're looking for other sources, do conservation. The pumping continues and hits the bottom line, which is at a 75% threshold. Then they stop pumping from this aquifer. And we told the company this up front, and we had a window of time where we thought this would reach their 50% threshold. And they are looking at alternative sources, but they're also looking at doubling the capacity of the plant. So there are some inherent conflicts that are going to be in front of us.
But that's a good place, I think, for us. I'm looking at the time, and I am understanding that you can join us again after session or this evening.
Yes, sir.
We didn't have a quorum when we started. I will call the meeting to order now, but then we were going to recess until 6:30 tonight. And we will continue with this presentation, hopefully get through all of their presentations on their requests for changes in the budget. And you all can think about your questions in the meantime. Thank you.
Thank you.
We're in recess.
We are going to reconvene while folks are getting settled. Since we had a quorum when we left, I would ask Representative Eakin if he would move approval of the minutes from February 8th and 15th.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So moved.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
The opposition is approved.
Thank you.
Sam Mueller, I understand the agency would like to proceed by finishing up ecological services
and then finishing up waters, and that just suits us fine.
Madam Chair, my name for the record is Lee Samuler, Director of the Division of Ecological Services, and I'll mention Meyer is supposed to be here too, but I think we're still waiting for him. So, interesting.
We could always invite the commissioner down if he wants to have a few words. I think he's disappearing.
Commissioner,
would you like to?
I've been summoned.
No, you haven't been summoned, but if you'd like to come down, we'd welcome you.
I have nothing to add.
Okay. Well, welcome back to the committee, and if you want to just pick up where we left off, I see you have your slides up and we have our folders out.
Okay. And this is slide 20 in the packet for Ecological Services, and I think we've pretty much covered this. I think we came to the end, but I just thought I'd hear real quick, but we have an initiative. I think we talked briefly before we ended about four new streams of revenue that we're proposing to fund both aquatic invasive species and terrestrial invasive species. So I will not, I think this is where we left off, unless there's any more questions about that. We've talked about what we can do with, we're proposing to raise revenue $785,000 the first year of the biennium, which will increase to $2.4 million the second year of the biennium. And we talked about how we're splitting those revenues between work on aquatic invasive species and terrestrial invasive species. And work on terrestrial invasive species will focus on state land management. And after that, there were just two other slides to wrap up what the initiatives were for Ecological Services. The first one has to do with environmental review. And this is an internal reallocation of $100,000 dedicated to helping our environmental review efforts. The beginning of our budget presentation talked about environmental review. It talked about how we've seen a significant increase in the number of projects over the last few years, and more importantly, how we've seen a significant increase in the complexity and size of individual projects. And although those projects, which are small in number that require an environmental impact statement, are paid by the project proposer, we're still seeing a significant number of large, complex projects that are only at the EAW stage that are providing additional work for us. And I believe, I know I prepared some information that I'm not sure it's been delivered to the committee yet that shows our, you had asked our total expenses on environmental review. We compiled that information and I presented it to Bob. I'm not sure it's been sent over to you yet, but we do have information on that. So you get a sense of our overall department expenditure on environmental review. Any questions on that? Okay, and then the last one has to do with the non-game wildlife program. And there are three pieces to this. Just briefly, the non-game wildlife program is still funded almost entirely by citizen contributions through the tax checkoff. So when you file your income or property tax refund, you're given the option to donate to the non-game wildlife fund that generates a little over $1 million a year, and that's still the principal source of revenue for this program. We have two components to this. This is focused on our educational work with the non-game program. We're looking for an increased appropriation to the non-game wildlife fund because there is a balance there of $35,000 the first year and $36,000 the second year. And then there's a second piece, which is an internal reallocation of $40,000 from the general fund and $40,000 from the game and fish fund. And the reason I'd like to point out, the reason there's a portion of this from the Game and Fish Fund, is that the curriculum that we focus on for Project Wild, which is an educational curriculum, focuses on also hunting and trapping and fishing. And we felt it was appropriate internally that a small portion of the funding for that program also comes from the Game and Fish Fund. So that, in a nutshell, is the end of the Ecological Services budget initiative.
Representative Hansen has a question. I have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Famuler, you don't have to provide this tonight, but at some point if I could see the non-game receipts just over time and what they've done, my understanding is they've kind of, they peaked early and then plateaued, and I'd just kind of like to see that trend.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we could do that. And in a nutshell, it's pretty much stayed steady. We've had a slight increase the last few years, but what's the biggest change in the contributions has been the number of people contributing. We had far more people contributing in the early years. smaller amounts of money, and what we have now is fewer people contributing larger amounts of money. So that's it, but it's basically held at around $1 million for the last 20 years. But we can provide you the details on that.
I had asked earlier about the chemicals you used to treat for curly leaf pondweed, and had an opportunity between our last hearing and this one to read what you've been doing in that area. And I was a bit surprised to see that you were using 2,4-D as one of the chemicals. And 2,4-D is a known endocrine disruptor. And wondering if you post lakes for no swimming when you do that.
Madam Chair, that's correct. We provide you a list of the number of chemicals. 2,4-D is a contact herbicide used primarily for Eurasian water milfoil control. And yes, the commercial applicators do most of the work with 2,4-D, and they are required, and we actually provide them with the signs for posting the property.
For how long?
I don't remember. I'd have to double-check that. Whatever's legally required by EPA, and I don't remember off the top of my head how long that is. I think it's at least 24 hours, but maybe longer.
The other thing I noticed when I was reading those studies, the summaries of those studies, is that the agency seemed to be looking at only about the amount of dieback of the curly leaf pondweed, and not what might be happening to the vertebrates in the water. And that seemed to be looking at only half the picture. Is that something you'd continue in the future, or would you be looking at what happens to the vertebrates at the same time?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we've not looked at that specifically with Eurasian water milfoil control. We have, there is another chemical listed in that summary that we provided you, fluoridone, which has been used lake-wide control. The 2,4-D is always spot treatment, and it's not applied lake-wide. But the one chemical on that list that's applied lake-wide is fluoridone, and we have done extensive studies that have looked at both invertebrates and fish populations in terms of impacts from fluoridone, and we've not found any.
I haven't seen what you are talking about. I was actually reading an older report, and that was just talking about, it was a summary of what you've done on invasives, and I was just reading about the curly leaf pondweed and was just surprised about the 2,4-D, thinking that was something that normally you wouldn't apply in lakes.
And Madam Chair, what we've provided and I worked on yesterday is we have a summary of all the chemicals that are applied for lake invasive species control by year, and the amount of pounds and the amount of gallons of different chemicals for the last 20 years, and that's you should get momentarily.
Okay, super. Yeah. Representative Hansen has another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as a follow-up, what you're talking about is commercial applications or non-commercial applications, but the homeowner or the lakeshore owner, they can apply on their own and are not required to report. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, they are required to report. And what the summary that we put together has two different columns, and when it comes to what we use for the ester 2,4-D that we use for milfoil, and there's one type of ester that's sold only in huge quantities, which is you can't get in a smaller form. It's a granular piece, and all the commercial applicators use that. There's another form that they only sell in small quantities, and that's what you can buy at Walmart and Home Depot for the individual property owner. But they still need a permit, and that permit, they still have to report on the amount of that they've applied.
Representative Clark, did you have a question?
I guess I'm just kind of shocked that 2,4-D is being deliberately put into water sources. And, you know, I mean, isn't this the defoliant that we saw in Vietnam and other places? And I thought it was banned, so it's not banned.
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, the particular formulation that we use is not banned, and it's very targeted towards, it's a contact herbicide only. and so it's not long-lasting in the system at all, and it only is works by contacting the foliage of the submerged plant, and they die within hours, basically. And it's not found elsewhere in the lake, but we do host the lake area where it's treated. So it's a chemical that's been researched by EPA. The type of formulation we use has been tested, and if it's applied at their baits that are on the label, there's no side effects to the aquatic invertebrates or fish.
Oh. Actually, I was worrying more about the people. And I'm just wondering, you know, some of these chemicals, we don't have standards that tell us what the rate should be in terms of children. They're just tested on adults, and we've been struggling with this with our own health department for a number of years. Do you know about the impact on human health and on children with that or any of the other lists? I haven't seen the list you're talking about, but is that something the department thinks about? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative Park, it's certainly something that we think about. That's why the sites are posted. And forgetting the technical term that you use when the type of studies that EPA has for both human health and animal and vertebrate health, and those are all part of the label information. So it does include, the label information does include or addresses potential impacts to human health.
Thank you. I guess maybe I'll just have to try to get some more information from this.
Representative Clark, I didn't see her. Go ahead.
No, that's all. I'm just thinking maybe we need to have some more information from environmental pathologists or some sort of way. I just don't understand. I guess I didn't know this was still being used in Minnesota or anywhere, really.
Representative Hackbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Bamuller, could you explain a little more in depth about the new invasive species account? I know we touched on this the other day, but maybe you could talk about the new fees that are going to be out there, how this new account's going to work. It looks to me like all the money's going to go into one account, and any of that money could be used for just about anything in these categories. You could use maybe the water, the extra charge on the boat license, for example. Some of that money might be going for terrestrial issues. It's all going into one account. I'm very, very concerned about that, and maybe also you can talk about is that just the new fee, the added $5, or is the whole $10 now going to go into the account, or is that going to be kept separate? Could you explain and clarify that a little bit for me?
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbar, that's a good question. In the past, the surcharge on boat licenses that is dedicated to aquatic exotics has just gone into the Water Rec account, for the Water Rec Fund. It hasn't gone into a separate invasive species account. So we haven't been able to always precisely track expenditures and revenues. We can by what we know the license sales are, but there's not a separate accounting within the Water Rec account. So what we're accomplishing two things here. One is to make that separate so that it's still within the Water Rec Fund, but it's a separate account within the fund. Your other question is a good one in terms of how we're going to keep track of what we're going to spend on terrestrial versus aquatic. And what we've projected is the watercraft surcharge increase and the fishing license surcharge will be 100% dedicated to aquatic exotics. So we feel that's keeping integrity in terms of where the source is and how it's going to be spent. With the utility trailer, we're going to split that. And that's a little bit arbitrary, but we figure about half of it is for terrestrial and half, I think it's 60-40 is what we've split. Is that? Yeah. And then with the recreational camper, that'll be 100% terrestrial. So we've looked at each source of revenue that we're proposing, and we'll keep that. The amount of expenditures for terrestrial will be coincident with what we believe is the revenues coming in. Does that address your question?
Madam Chair.
Representative Hackbar.
And is it just the new $5 that's added, or is it the whole amount that's going to go into the account? Is that changing so that previous $5 is now also going to go into this new special account? And is this going to be reflected in the spreadsheets when we see this in the budget before our committee?
Madam Chair, Representative Heckfarth, the whole surcharge will be moved into this new account, and yes, you should be able to track that. Part of what's happened over the years, and what we're actually going to be doing, is during the last couple of years, rather than raising an increase in the surcharge, we have also used some money under the broader water recreation account in addition to what we are gathering from the surcharge for aquatic invasive species. And what we're going to do over the years is pay back that account and keep a new, clean, separate account for invasives. Does that make sense?
And Madam Chair, is it going to be reflected in the spreadsheets when we have the bill before us? The breakdown that you talked about.
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, in terms of the revenues?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Hackbarth.
These are some new fees that I think the Republican caucus took some heat from the DFL caucus last session about, adding fees and increasing fees and creating new fees. I'm just curious to see how the DFL caucus is going to handle some of these new fees that are coming forward in this budget.
You know, I am curious about that too, Representative Hackbarth. I'm also curious about our inability to keep down the invasives and having 10 new lakes contaminated each year does not feel acceptable to me. And maybe that's one of the things that we are going to have to discuss as a group. What is an acceptable level of, you know, new water bodies having a new invasive in them? I think there was one of our slides in here, or one of the slides in the book, that talked about 10 new lakes a year, which is the standard that the DNR is setting for allowing a new invasive in. And we haven't, as a committee, said yay or nay. That's a good idea or a bad idea? That's too fast or not? And so I'll be looking forward to what everybody has to say about that, including you.
Well, Madam Chair, I agree with you, and I think we also heard some testimony that once these exotics are introduced, there's not much that we can do to stop them. So I'm not sure if this money is going to all go down a rat hole, if we're actually going to do some good with the money. So, like you always say, I want to see what the outcomes are going to be and what they're going to do with the money.
As I understand it, with the new money, they still expect that 10 new lakes will be contaminated each year. Do I have that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hackbarth, we cannot do a linear relationship between the number of new infestations and the investments. What we're going to be doing is, as we discussed last time, is the largest percentage of funding is going to go towards enforcement. Then the second piece is for control efforts, and the third for increased access inspection work. And we hope to stem the tide of the increases, but I cannot sit here and tell you that if we spent a penny more, if we spent a million more, that we're not going to have another new lake with milfoil in a year. But I think we can say, and that's one of the reasons for showing the comparison of Minnesota to the other states, is when you look at the investment Minnesota has made, we have significantly reduced the impact or the rate of increase of new infestations in Minnesota to our neighboring states, Wisconsin and Michigan, that have not spent nearly as much funding as we have. So our investments have made a significant impact.
Okay. Representative Doty has a question. Is it on this subject?
Yes, this subject. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Van Mueller, can you comment on the success rate of treating, let's say, curly leaf pondweed? If a permit is granted, 2,4-D or whatever is applied, is this like going to come back each year? Do you expect to return to that same lake and hit it again and again? Or are there success stories? Are there horrible stories? Just to give us a sense of how effective this is.
Madam Chair, so what it depends on what your goal is, and what our goal is, I mentioned last time, is we don't talk about eradication anymore. What we talk about is managing the level of the infestation. And we've been very successful in managing the level of the infestation to reduce the overall impact on recreational use of the lake, and sometimes really reducing the overall spread of the species. When you look at contact herbicides, you're just reducing the small area of the infestation. One of the biggest issues out there is whether or not we should be doing lake-wide treatments with fluoridone, which totally eliminates the plant, probably either curly leaf or milfoil, for probably at best 3 to 4 years. But then it's likely to come back again. So the question is, a lot of lake associations really want to achieve that level of control for 3 to 4 years. And what we've been concerned about, is because it is a lake-wide chemical, what are the impacts on the other species? And our work to date shows that they're minimal, depending on the type of lake that you're looking at. Sometimes when you treat the whole lake for an invasive, you can actually make the situation worse. And it depends on the type of lake. So there's no silver bullet. You really need to have good information on the lake and what the outcome goal is, both from a biological fisheries standpoint and from a recreational standpoint, to decide on what you want to achieve there.
Quick follow-up. So in general, then, thank you, Madam Chair. In general, then, the spot treatments would be yearly just to contain, correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's correct.
Thank you.
I think this conversation about curly leaf pondweed would be good to maybe have a smaller group get together and discuss it, because one of the things that I also picked up in the readings was that one of the problems is probably that there's just simply too much phosphorus in that lake to start with, and that the lake is unhealthy to start with. So if you could get your lake healthier, it would be more resistant and healthier by not having so much phosphorus. Am I correct in that?
Madam Chair, that is correct. If the lake is already receiving a lot of phosphorus and you eliminate the curly leaf pondweed, you could just create a lake green pea soup with an algal bloom, because something's going to fill that void. When the curly leaf pondweed is gone, the algae can fill that void, and you end up with a really thick pea soup lake, which we don't want aesthetically either. And depending on the lake, the curly leaf may actually be a better option and provide more fish habitat than the algal bloom. And so that's really important to look at the whole watershed and look at all the factors. And if phosphorus is a real big issue, that needs to be taken into consideration in terms of what your long-term goal is.
Well, for some of our lakes that are asking for year after year of chemical treatment, I mean, it's maybe cheaper each year to do that, but in the long run, we may be better off cleaning up the lake, the phosphorus in the lake, and we need to have some discussions about that. So for folks who are interested in that, I think maybe you could arrange a time for folks if they would do that, to do that. Because I know there's interest and tension there.
Madam Chair, if I just might add one more thing. So we can't promise any outcome, but I think what we're looking at is to allow lakeshore homeowners to have a number of different tools in the tool chest as they look at different options for cleaning up the lake. And certainly having ability to manage the invasive species is one of many tools that you need to look at.
And I think we need to talk about, does every lakeshore owner give permission because they have some riparian rights here, and what is all the law there? And I don't know that. But that's a good first of all.
I think Representative Dill has a bill to take care of that problem.
Get rid of riparian ownership?
No.
Huh? You can do it that way, huh?
Representative Dill has a bill that addresses this issue.
Representative Knuth has a friend.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is more of a comment in framing this whole discussion, having thought a lot about invasive species. And basically, when you're looking at invasive species, you have an introduction, and then you have establishment, and then you have an invasion, and then naturalization of the species, which usually we don't get the naturalization in our lakes with the weeds and other sorts of things. And I think the points we're looking at, your point well taken of the phosphorus making it harder for our invasives to compete. We don't let them get established in the education. We don't let them get introduced as much into our lakes. And so I would just like to say, encouraging the DNR to look, to continue the practice of focusing on preventing introductions and establishment, because once you're established, you're not going to eradicate it. I agree with that 100%.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's our first goal. Management and control is our third goal, but our first goal is to prevent in the first place. Yes,
I think my point and what I'd like to this for folks to discuss is management comes in two ways, or prevention comes in two ways, from not having somebody introduce it and from having a healthy lake that wouldn't be a good receptor. So, I don't see any other questions. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think we will now have the Director of the Division of Waters again with us.
Madam Chair, we're going to continue with the groundwater presentation.
Mm-hmm. I think we left off at conservation outcomes.
Madam Chair, for the record, Kent Locke, Solar Director of Division of Waters. This is the slide that I believe we left off at, which is a slide of the permit conditions for the Granite Falls ethanol plant. And the one thing that I was advised after our morning discussion was that Granite Falls last week has started using Minnesota River water, so they have switched sources from groundwater to surface water. So you would see this aquifer then rebound, and I expect they would be looking at that as an emergency supply or an alternative supply if river levels get low. So they did. We had issued them this temporary permit, so they did what we were looking for: look for alternative sources, because we knew this was not sustainable. This slide shows conservation outcomes, and actually we had gotten into some of these topics with earlier questions.
Mr. Locke, I think I'm not understanding what you just said to us. The city of Granite Falls has gone back to river water. Is that what you said? Or is it the energy company?
Madam Chair, if I had said city, I misspoke. It's the ethanol plant that switched to Minnesota River water.
Okay. Now it makes sense. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry for the confusion. The conservation outcomes. Certainly elimination of wasteful uses, the ones through heating and cooling. We talked about a little bit this morning, and we have a slide that shows that. We've eliminated the use of groundwater to augment surface water. There have been proposals to use groundwater to fill up lakes when lakes were low, and that's been eliminated. And we do require efficient uses by all users through best management practices, drought measures, and benchmarks. And then we're also looking to integrate with water supply planning the demand reduction measures for new wells. We've seen in the past communities that instead of reducing the demand would just put in a new well, so they would deal with the supply side of that equation. And cities, you know, they use a lot of water in the summer, and they kind of balance their, I suppose they balance their books by selling water in the summer versus the winter demand. So there hasn't been a real incentive to save water, because it is something that generates income. And that trend is changing gradually, so communities are better at through the emergency and conservation plans at developing conservation measures. and the water supply planning and permitting. We're in discussions with Met Council with the exercise that they're going through now on combining the metro area at least, our water supply planning and theirs. And there's a bill in our technical bill that helps integrate those two processes. This slide shows the once-through systems of water use. And you see the peak. The peaks in this chart are the 1988 and 89, which are drought years. High water use, 11 billion gallons a year for once-through cooling. The legislation passed required them to be all converted by the life of their system or 2010. So by 2010, we'll be down to, a billion gallons or so a year. And the reason that there's still some left there is that there are exemptions for nonprofits, churches, and the H.B. Fuller exemption that we talked about this morning. So this has gone in the right direction. It won't be totally eliminated, but it is certainly a much smaller number than it was. This is kind of a busy chart. I think you also have it in your handout. What this shows is the gallons of water used per gallon of ethanol produced. And basically the average is about between 4 and 5 now in the 2005 numbers. And you see on some of these where the use went from in 1998 at 10 gallons per of water for a gallon of ethanol, you know, down to 4.5. So they've exercised conservation and made adjustments in manufacturing processes to save water. So there has been efficiency achieved in the plants. And I believe we're the only state that's actually tracking this and developing these kinds of benchmarks. This, we had discussion both from the Groundwater Association and from us earlier about the Buffalo Aquifer near Moorhead. And this shows the water levels in that aquifer, and you can see where the conjunctive use begins. The conjunctive use is where the city of Moorhead then switched to surface water for their municipal water supply. And you can see how this aquifer rebounded in elevation. And the city is looking at having the Buffalo Aquifer available for their emergency supply for drought use. And there are a couple other communities that have this kind of conjunctive use. St. Paul, for example, uses predominantly Mississippi River water, although they do have a system of wells so they can augment their supply. So it is a good process, or the conjunctive use is something that we should be encouraging. When you talk about water pricing, we've required water use fees for quite some time, although they really got beefed up in 1989-1990, and they've been amended a couple times since then, 2003 and then 2005. All the revenue of our water use fees goes to the general fund. We'll have collected about $4.4 million in fiscal 06. And you do have a handout that shows the schedule of those fees and the amounts that we've collected as it's gradually increased. The 2003 fee increase was basically adjusting for inflation from when they initially were set back in 1989. And then, Madam Chair, you'll recall that you raised that fee schedule by $1 per category, and that generated an extra $300,000. And that I think as that left the House, it was proposed that money be dedicated to waters for water conservation and some of those things. The final result of that legislative session resulted in the fee increase, but the money went elsewhere. The other change that we made in 2005 was to have a surcharge on summer water use. You recall the Lakeville slide that showed 4 or 5 times the water use in July than in January. And pricing is one way to encourage conservation. You certainly see it with gasoline. And with water pricing, we were looking at that same theory. We also, as we proposed this, that we wanted to dedicate that money to conservation programs and additional exploration and essentially groundwater research and monitoring. There again, the fee was accepted, although that money was used elsewhere. I think I'll have to quit proposing fee increases. The increasing block structure, we have that in the state fee for, as you say, as you use more water, the price increases. Most communities have that type of fee structure now. I'm not aware of too many that don't.
Actually, Madam Chair, Jim Jaffs for the record, Assistant Director of Divisional Waters. As Ken Laxmo mentioned before a community can put in a new well, they need to get approval from the Department of Health. And before they can get that approval, they have to implement demand reduction measures, which include conservation rate structure evaluation and also an education feature there, because usually demand reduction is a low-cost alternative compared to alternative supply. So we are seeing a trend for communities going more toward a conservation rate structure with increasing blocks or summer surcharges and things like that.
So the summer surcharge generated $627,000 for 2005. And the other thing on this slide that I haven't already talked about was just a change also in fees for once you cool it.
I'm sorry, Representative Gunther has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Lacasmo, you got my curiosity. It's killing me. Where was it used, the $300,000 in fine money? I think I was in the conference committee, and I can't remember.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, I don't know.
I'm glad I'm not the only one, Madam Chairman.
Madam Chair, to continue, then also adjusted was the one through heating and cooling fee, which changed from $200 per million gallons to $300 per million gallons. And that's looked at as a, more of a punitive fee, I hate to use that word, but it's a higher fee to discourage a poor use of water. And if there are poor or wasteful uses of water, those probably should be paying more than the other fees that we've addressed. So we have desired actions to achieve
Before you go on to that, I'm sitting here just doing some thinking of this water fee changes and how $20 per million gallons would discourage water use. I mean, if I'm taking a gallon into my house, what is that costing me?
Madam Chair, I don't have those calculations with me. I did look at that a little bit last year when we were doing that. If you're on a municipal water user in Minneapolis or in the metro area, you pay, or anywhere, I guess, you're paying the, it used to be 521 fee to Department of Health, now it's 636 or something like that. This water fee would equate to a fraction of that, as I recall. But I don't remember the fraction. It was more cents than dollars. We can calculate that and provide it to the committee.
Okay. Well, what I was looking at, you were comparing the price of water to the price of gas. And I know what I'm paying for gasoline right now. I have no idea what I'm paying for water. I don't know whether anybody else around this. But my sense is I don't pay anywhere near as much for water as I do for gasoline. What do I pay for a gallon of water?
Madam
Roughly.
Chair, I would say the average cost for a 1,000-gallon unit of water, it's usually the unit that they sell water in, is between $1.50 and $2.
So what would that mean for a gallon that I'm purchasing? Do the math for me.
Well, a gallon of gas at this point costs $2.22 or something compared to 1,000 gallons of water for that same cost.
1,000 gallons of water for the same cost. So I don't see how we can talk about conservation when they're putting in a fraction of a penny. I mean, I know we started conserving gasoline when it was going up by 50 cents, but that's...
At $20 per million gallon, is 0.002 per gallon.
2/1000th of a century. Thank you for the math. Okay. And so, if I'm paying a dollar, what did you say, a dollar something for 10,000 gallons, so I'm paying a penny a gallon? Is that right?
Madam Chair, it's about $1.50 to $2 on average for 1,000 gallons of water.
So, a penny?
No. Madam Chair, it would be 2/10 of a cent.
2/10 of a cent.
Madam Chair.
I don't feel like conserving.
Madam Chair.
Yeah. Representative.
Yes. Madam Chair, maybe you put it in terms of what does it cost you to brush your teeth or what does it cost you to take a shower? Maybe then it would be a little more meaningful rather than per gallon. I don't know.
I sweat 6 gallons to take a shower.
So I am hearing the length of my shower is probably 2 cents.
Madam Chair, this is one of the challenges that we're going to mention in a moment.
Okay, go ahead. You've challenged me, certainly.
Madam Chair, the other thing that's unfair is how the cities who pay this fee transfer it on to the, you know, to the individual consumer. It might just be absorbed, I expect, and you see it as part of your overall fee per 1,000 gallons. Mm-hmm. The desired actions that we have here, integrating sustainability into municipal water supply plans. I think Jim just mentioned that we look at dealing with the demand side of that equation instead of just doing drilling new wells and adding new wells. Master water supply plan for the Twin Cities metro area. We're in the process with Met Council of addressing that.
We're currently working with Met Council and others to develop a master plan. This is an effort that Met Council is undertaking. It would basically try to get us in a longer planning range, because right now sewers are planned on a 50-year basis to accommodate growth, but they don't look at water supply in that same time frame. It's much shorter. We found that that's really slowing down the permitting process, and it's not addressing all of our resource sustainability issues. So we're trying to match up those time frames and look forward to completing that master plan yet this year.
The next was identify monitoring needs and priorities. I think you heard Jeff Stoner this morning say that our existing monitoring system is not comprehensive. We need to address how to make that more comprehensive. The mass water level readings to identify local changes in water supplies. This we're doing, and we will complete in the next year with the with our other partners, the USGS and the MGS. That's taking readings over a real short period of time. You take 200 well readings over the course of a week or so to capture in time those levels. Resource investigations and mapping to help with water supply planning. Development of resource protection thresholds and aquifer management plans. Those are really on a case-by-case basis. And then increased conservation to improve water use efficiency. The challenges are, if we mentioned this, our funding is really dealing with today's demands, not the future water supply issues. We look at future water supply as much as we can, but we do have permits that come in that we need to deal with on an ongoing basis. We certainly, ethanol has directed a lot of our efforts towards that in the last few months. Better planning for sustainable development. I think Jim just mentioned the source of sewer water if they plan for sewer systems 50 years out, but not looking at. And as you look towards the northwest up the St. Cloud Corridor, they're planning for sewer, but where's all that water coming from? The bioenergy economic development, that's the ethanol issue, how we apply conservation measures, how we have the data for decisions. Resource investigations and county atlases, we're in the process. We are doing those. Those are a slow process for an atlas. Takes multiple years to complete. Once counties have those, they do use them for decision-making. State and local monitoring plans, again, resource protection limits, aquifer management plans. This is kind of a busy slide, but it does show the ethanol facilities in Minnesota that are existing and proposed. And you can see the where the availability of groundwater is. The slide that we showed first exactly showed most of these slides already. I don't know if we can point. But you do note that the ethanol is being proposed in areas of limited aquifers, so there are challenges associated with those. And the chart in the bottom right shows the where Minnesota changes from. Actually, I have that later on, I guess.
Before you drop the ethanol issue, we have this list of plants that are functioning now, and I can't equate that with the map. So we have how many now, and how many are you in the process of permitting?
We have 16 current plants and another six or so being proposed.
And what do they pay for their water?
Madam Chair, they would pay based on the, depending on their amount of use. So if you looked at our other handout that showed the fee structure, they're a 100 million gallon plant, and they're using 5 gallons of water per gallon of ethanol. They'd be using 500 million gallons of water in a year. That would get them to the maximum fee of $7.50 per million. So it'd be $7.50 per million or less.
And so multiply that for a year, what would they be paying for water?
I think it's about $3,000.
$3,000 for how much water?
For 500 million gallons of water.
500 million. I can't ask you if that's too cheap, but it just strikes me that if this is...
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, that would be $3,750 if it would be a 100 million gallon ethanol plant using 500 million gallons of water.
So they say that again so I get...
$3,750 would be today's fee for 500 million gallons of water.
Per month? Yearly.
Annual.
I don't know. Does anybody else in the committee seem to think it's as low as I do? Representative Gunther?
Madam Chairman, Mr. Lockesmore, do you know, have any idea how much effluent does a town of 11,000 give off in a sewage treatment plant a year?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Because you could certainly replace that for the water you pump out of the aquifer.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, I don't know that number. There are, I know ethanol plants have looked at using wastewater as a source of water, but the actual quantities that would be generated by a community that size, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. There's two proposals given in my area. One was using the wastewater, the effluent after treatment, that would go down in the stream and is considered potable water. In pumping that into the ethanol plant, the problem with it is the discharge water was coming after that, where the second ethanol plant that was permitted in the county I live in recycles the water completely and takes the salts that we're giving off, and it's a closed system. It isn't discharged into anything. So as the water usage is one problem, the discharge is another. And one was satisfied with one of the things, the other one was the other. So I paid a lot of attention to what alternatives there are, and there certainly are alternatives. The second ethanol plant, the Veresen ethanol plant, was permitted the same day it was put forth the Citizens Board and the PCA, because what they did is they recycled the water and then took the minerals out of the water and landfill the salts from the minerals. And they thought that was a wonderful solution. So there are solutions to ethanol plants, much more in Minnesota than there are in Iowa.
It just strikes me, Representative Gunther, that the pricing wouldn't encourage that kind of closed-loop system.
Mm-hmm.
Because, or does, is it a fairly inexpensive system? I don't know.
I think the second ethanol system, the Veresen one, was not over the Prairie du Chien aquifer where there was an adequate supply of water, or as much of a supply of water. There's two aquifers they were going to draw from. The one in Fairmont is still drawing off of two aquifers, I believe. They're both 100 million plus gallon plants. So it's, I don't think raising the water fee would break them, but I don't think that the state of Minnesota should go and isolate one industry to charge more for. If we're going to charge them more, we should charge everybody more. But I'm glad they aren't drawing ours out of a river, too.
This is not a renewable resource, necessarily. It's not like the ethanol. So this is an interesting thing for the committee to think about.
I've studied long and hard on the situation.
Of course. You're going to be giving us great advice, aren't you?
I'm looking forward to it.
You want to go on?
Yes, Madam Chair. There are technical needs to answer some of these questions. This map on the left shows the county atlases and the regional hydrologic assessments. The dark blue are completed county atlases, and these are done in the greatest population, the greatest use areas first, and you see the lighter blue are the ones in progress. And these are done cooperatively with the county, so you have to get a county that's willing to do it. So, and I think you heard from testifiers this morning that, you know, Sherburne and Wright are areas where we'd like to pursue atlases. The regional hydrologic assessments are more of a quick snapshot of water conditions, and those are along the Red River Valley, as you see here. The chart on the right with the red line is just on a pump test. The reaction of water levels from that specific test. And then once you shut off a pump test, you can see how fast the water levels rebound to get a condition of the aquifer. This map shows the ground water level network that we have in place right now. And there's 750 observation wells that we have around the state. They're largely monitored by soil and water conservation districts with a co-op agreement that we have with them. And some are monitored by other agencies or the department. And these are not a, this doesn't represent a comprehensive system where we have an observation well in every aquifer in every county. I mean, there are gaps in the system, and some observation wells are very expensive. To do a amount of time an observation well here in the Twin Cities area would probably cost $100,000 plus, because it's a very deep well, and it would be, you know, the deeper the well, the more it costs, obviously, to drill. So it's an expensive system to maintain or to expand. The maintenance is basically just the cost of the readings. This map shows, you recall Jeff Storer had the map showing the amount of runoff and as it got drier as you went west. And this shows the yellow in the middle is the transition zone between semi-humid, where the precipitation is more than evaporation on the eastern border. And in the, we then move to semi-arid, where precipitation is less than evaporation in the west. And that also is going to impact groundwater supplies. Even though there are different types of systems, there is just less water in the south and the west areas of the state. And it's very difficult, I mean, this is more of a surface water issue, but it's really difficult to separate surface water and groundwater issues. this, just to put things in perspective, this is a recent drought monitor that shows the red area is still extreme drought, which is the northeast and north central areas of the state, and much of the state is in some form of drought, or at least from abnormally dry to severe drought. So we're going to, you know, it's very likely that we'll be dealing with drought issues this year, and that may mean more well interferences, more conflicts, more demand on groundwater. And Madam Chair, that ends the quick overview on groundwater.
Good presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lacasmo, my question is about irrigation wells, and the DNR does permit irrigation wells, is that correct?
That's correct.
And so in some of the shallow sand superficial aquifers, they're kind of on the developing fringe of the Twin Cities. They were used for potato, irrigation wells were used for potato production or nursery stock, maybe in Dakota County, or seed corn. Just wondering what's happening as we have increased urbanization. Are there fewer permits? Are there more, some of the agricultural irrigation wells shutting down, or just what's happening as we have the encroaching urbanization on those permits?
Madam Chair, Representative, we have about 6,800 active water appropriation permits. The majority of those, around 3,800 to 4,000, are for agricultural irrigation operations. And surprisingly, that number has been fairly stable for a number of years. We irrigate, I believe, about 500,000 acres per year. The other largest group of permits would be public water supply, about 900 or so permits.
My last question would be, you have your groundwater level network and a number of wells. What would be a reasonable number, in your judgment, to tell Minnesotans what they need to know?
Madam Chair, we're right now in the process of evaluating our monitoring networks, so I don't have a good answer. I've asked that question of our staff, and we can provide you a more detailed response. This may speed up the answer. Thank you for the question.
Okay, are there any other questions I should ask you?
Madam Chair, no.
I'd be glad to do it. I don't see any other questions. Issues?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will. Let me get set up here. Madam Chair, I think some of these the slides we will have just discussed because of the groundwater presentation. We didn't realize these would be, you know, right together. But the current year's, this first pie chart is the current year's funding, or current biennium's funding. And I know you heard from Ecological Services in their presentation that their pie chart was maybe the most diverse. And I think ours is kind of the opposite. Ours is probably the simplest. And that's not necessarily good. It's not something where you want to put all your eggs in one basket and all our eggs are in the general fund basket. The federal money is the other big piece here of $5 million, and that is largely pass-through money that goes to the Coastal Zone Management Program and the North Shore of Lake Superior, and then the FEMA, Federal Emergency Management Area, the agency, their floodplain programs and the commitments we have with the federal government. The Division of Waters is about half of our people are in the field and half are in the central office. And out of, so we're largely staff. Our budget is about 80% salaries. You know, as I was looking at this, and I know you've looked at lots of pie charts, and I thought, I think Bob likes this, I thought the a comparison or analogy would be with the solar system. And since we have eight divisions and now there's eight planets since Pluto was taken off, that, you know, the Fish and Wildlife budget is more more like Jupiter, and the Division of Waters budget is more like Mercury. So you have to look at the relative sizes of these pie charts. The DNR, for our core functions, we have three that are public waters protection through regulation, and the land use control, shoreline, wildland, scenic rivers, floodplain programs, and we provide the oversight to local government. These are administered through our partners in the counties and municipalities. And we have a grant program for flood damage reduction. Water supply management through the appropriation permits. There's 6,800 water appropriation permits in existence. And then it's the technical services to support the decision making that we and local government make. Our priority outcomes we'll be discussing here real briefly: flood hazard mitigation, water supply protection management, and conservation of natural resources. One of our critical trends is flood damage. The this picture is Oslo, Minnesota, and the key thing that I like to point out in this picture is that this project was built with the Corps of Engineers. It cost $1.6 million to build, and then in the 1997 and 1998 floods, there was over $16 million in damages avoided by this project. So it's very cost-effective. The 1997 flood, the devastation that that had in the Red River Valley, provided the impetus to seriously fund flood hazard mitigation, and we've made great strides in that area. And that's largely done through bonding, not through general fund, and through the regular budget. This slide shows the number of homes removed from the floodplain. And homes are removed from the floodplain in two ways. One, where we actually acquire or not us, but the we do grants to the local government. They would acquire a home and actually demolish or move it off of the property. The other way would be that you do a ring dike or some type of levee system that protects the area from flooding, and then that area is removed from the floodplain or from the risk, and that that home then would be removed from the floodplain. So that's how these numbers have gotten to 1,500 or 1,700 about. And the next slide shows one of the ongoing projects for flood hazard mitigation. This is the city of Crookston, and you see the Red Lake River curving through the city, and the neighborhoods shaded in are at significant risk of flooding. They were within, you know, an inch or so of being just like East Grand Forks in 1997, and they've been quite close since then of flooding, and there's 451 homes that are at significant risk. And we're in the process of doing a levee and acquisition and removal of some homes, and then a levee system to protect these neighborhoods. And the remaining cost for doing this is, you know, probably in the neighborhood a total cost of $20 million or so. The next trend to touch on is shoreline development. I know there's some interest in that this year. On the left, you see the castles or cabins. We're seeing conversion of the small seasonal cabins to large year-round big structures on lakes. On the right, the top picture on the right shows a shallow bay in the Whitefish chain. The bottom picture shows how the landowner altered it to meet his needs. And this is something that's done, you know, can be done in a matter of hours or days, and it's very tough to control that. What happened, you know, here is it took significant work from our Division of Enforcement, Ecological Services, and Waters and the county staff to deal with getting the sand removed from the beach that was placed. And there were, you know, WACA wetlands also impacted up behind the trees that you see in the bottom picture. And while something like this happens in hours or days, it takes years to get the restoration in place and then actually conducted. This individual actually bought a weed harvester to be able to clear out that bay as he desired, and we've got that, we believe, now under control, and with a restoration plan that's in place, that we should see this restored to a condition a little closer to the top picture. And, you know, the results, or one of the, doing this is a misdemeanor. So the penalty of this action is only $700 and or 90 days. I've had bills in the past deal with an administrative penalty order, so we could make this, cost more, and those have not, they haven't been successful the last couple of years.
Excuse me, who had a question? Oh, Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As an old county commissioner, and as someone who lives in the middle of the cabins to castle phenomena, it's coming, of course. It's just seems to me that if the tools are there and the partnership is there between the agency and the counties, with all of the rules and all of the statutory requirements, all it takes is some will, I think. But I'm always harping about the partnership between the state agency and the local unit of government, and I think this is a very, very classic example of what needs to be strengthened before we do have small 500-acre lakes looking like this photo you have here. And I don't think that that's in the best interest of anybody, so just the thought.
Thank you.
As you're thinking, you said that you do not have administrative penalty authority for restoring a wetland that was changed by someone. Did I hear that correctly?
Madam Chair, yes. We have the authority to order the restoration, both the Division of Waters and Division of Ecological Services. This project also dealt with the removal of aquatic vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
Administrative penalty order would be levying a monetary penalty. That's the authority that we don't have. We have the authority to order and seek restoration and obtain that.
Administrative penalty orders have been very cleverly used to get people to restore without having to go to court, which is, of course, expensive, and who wants to make anyone a criminal? I don't know. So maybe that is an issue that needs to be revisited at some point.
Madam Chair, yes, I would agree with you. The outcomes that we're looking at shoreline management is for better land use planning and development, local administration and enforcement were identified as key issues in the North Central Lakes survey that we did at the start of that project. You can have good ordinances, but you need also the local administration and enforcement to make them work. The land use zoning is a partnership with local government you'll see I say 85 counties, not 87, because Ramsey and Hennepin don't have zoning authority. And there's about 150 municipalities that we're dealing with shoreline zoning. And we're also increasing the LGU education training, and we're continuing to develop tools and working with local units of government. This slide actually could be updated a little bit. I think there's a couple more counties, but the green are those counties that have adopted some parts of the alternative standards that we recently developed, and the yellow counties shown here are in the process. They're proposing to adopt some of those standards. This, we just went through a lot on the groundwater presentation. This is a chart just showing the water level declines. This is the Mount Simon aquifer in Stabby. And you can see the effects of seasonal water, lawn watering, where you have the wild swings in the water elevation. This chart we just went through also. This was the Granite Falls Resource Protection levels. I think we've covered all these things previously. And I'll just quickly go through. This chart on the left shows the red is the production of ethanol and the blue is the consumption of ethanol. And the map shows the 16 plants that are currently producing about 550 million gallons of ethanol a year. Madam Chair, members, that brings us to the legislative initiative dealing with the Division of Waters. Several of these we've already spoken about, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time dealing with those. The Clean Water Legacy Program or initiative we spoke of with Director Famuler and Ecological Services is in conjunction with the Division of Waters. That $2 million is spent with Ecological Services and through Waters. The major outcome of that proposal for Waters will be to $500,000 for the stream flow monitoring. Get us 81 stream flow gauges or stream flow gauges in all 81 major watersheds by the end of the next fiscal year, and then start replacing by FY09, and then start to replace the oldest ones and bring the technology and the stream flow monitors that we have up to current levels. It helps us to really work and to look at the flow and the TMBL process, so we know when those peak flow dates are, what's going on with them, and help us coordinate our research there. The second piece of the change items in water, Director Lacrosmo spoke of the ethanol issues. If you go to the fact sheet package that you have in front of you on page 11, is the fact sheet we have associated with the ethanol program, or the ethanol change item, and I just want to talk about that real quickly. This is $858,000 each year to help us meet the demands caused by the expansion of not only ethanol, but other biofuels that we're looking at right now, to look at what's going on out there. This request will take or will provide for $100,000 for internal and external communications and program coordination, $330,000 for additional groundwater technical expertise, actual hydrologists to help us do the work, $110,000 for a field hydrologist, $85,000 for an environmental review planner. This was spoke of in the ecological services portion, and $233,000 for increased testing, analysis, and monitoring. This proposal is really needed to help us move forward with the work that we need to do and to help us meet the demands that we're facing with the increased environmental review activities that we spoke of earlier with Director Famuler.
Let's talk about why the folks who are asking for the permits are not paying this cost. We've now established that we're giving them water as a gift. Why is it that these costs are not included in the cost of their permit? I mean, we're dealing right now with great capital. This is the gold rush with huge amounts of venture capital. Do we need to be subsidizing them?
Madam Chair, the existing process, we have a permit application fee that's minimal, and there's not a means to pass on the costs of our processing of permits or the investigation to a prospective permittee. The only process where I see prospective permittees paying is when there's an environmental impact statement required. Those permittees pay the cost of conducting the EIS. And we're seeing that, we're doing that in mining proposals that are currently ongoing. But with ethanol, those costs of review, unless there's an EIS, rest with the agencies.
So they essentially pay a minimal fee. Do they have to go out and do well testing to see if where there are wells, or does the public, do my city taxpayers pay for that?
Madam Chair, As we work through the process, there are well tests, pump tests that need to be done. They may have to, you know, put in a production well to conduct that. Those are costs that are borne by the company. And we do oversight and we do help design that test, so we make sure we get the information that we need. And there may be multiple tests that need to be done depending on what the results are. So those costs are done by the project proposer.
Do you have an estimate, I'm sure you do, of the cost of providing a permit? An average cost, what does it cost to get a permit? What does it cost us to give a permit? Let me put it that way.
Madam Chair, you're talking about an ethanol permit.
An ethanol or any other permit?
But, Madam Chair, the other permits, if it's a beach sand blanket type project or something that takes minimal review, or bridge and culvert or something, that those aren't nearly as involved. And there, the cost of doing that is still probably, it could be $1,000. By the time you're done, if you have 10 hours of or 10 hours of time in it. For an ethanol project, something where you have to do exhaustive pumping tests, and we're in the thousands of dollars. We could try to work up a number and provide it to the committee, but off the top of my head, I guess I'd have to talk with Jay or some of our experts here that see how much time we're committing. But we have committed a significant amount of division time to dealing with the ethanol issues that are in front of us.
I think it would be helpful to know that, so we have an understanding of how much a permit holder or applicant pays. And what I'm understanding is a range probably starting at about $1,000. Up to, and we don't know what the top of that range is, so it would be helpful to understand that.
Madam Chair, I don't know if this is helpful or not helpful, but I'm somewhat interested in and involved in one of the projects that's currently under review, which is the Minnesota Steel and Iron Project in my district. And for members of the committee, I can assure you the company is paying lots and lots and lots of money, and I can also assure you that the company is applying all sorts of pressures on the professionals in the department to expedite the permitting and get things done yesterday. And I just want to compliment the department for the job it's doing on that project. Mm-hmm. On that project.
Well, there does seem to be a distinction, help me out here, a distinction between an EIS, which this sounds like it is,
right.
But if you don't have an EIS, then state taxpayers pay for it. So it would be helpful to know the range of costs for those kinds of permits, particularly when we're dealing with larger facilities. I can imagine that for the smaller things that you were talking about, that is just a general service to the public. But when we're dealing with very large facilities that are very demanding, I think it's important to understand what those costs are. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I would also like to know what the ethanol industry brings in economic development revenue to the state. I know the figures were in the billions the last I heard, which certainly is more than less than 1 million. And I'd like to have a breakdown of the costs, of how much the DNR spends in total for each ethanol plant, as well as what the ethanol plant pays. And I will get that same information from Iowa along with the permitting period of time, and find out why there are 41 plants in Iowa and only, how many did you say in Minnesota?
16.
Because it has a very big economic development impact on the state, as well as an environmental impact, in that the people in the metro area no longer have to sit in lines and pay $8 to have their fuel emissions tested, like they did when I first got elected.
Madam Chair, we are preparing a response related to environmental review and EIS for ecological services. We can incorporate this information. Perhaps we can amend Representative Anzell's bill for the local economic impact for timber with the ethanol. But just kiddingly, we'll work on the ethanol question. I'll probably have to work with Commerce or other agencies to get some of that local impact stuff for you.
And the Department of Ag, too.
Okay. We'll see what we can do to coordinate some of those answers for you. Madam Chair, I'd like to move on to the last one, which we've already touched upon as well. $100,000 within our DNR budget reallocations. We spoke of briefly in talking about the overall general fund budget reallocations. That's going to go to the coordination efforts that we need to do for some of these issues as well. Coordinating all of our review permitting activities, so we're talking with other agencies, making sure we're doing this as efficiently, as effective as possible. So getting the coordinator position established to help with our permitting and environmental review activities, DAW things. That is the legislative budget issues related to the Division of Waters. You can see this last slide here shows Mercury, as Kent called it, and I warned him not to use Mercury. I told him you could use a different planet, but you understand the size part of it anyway. $26 million or 76.4% of the Waters Division is general fund. And again, the total is very important, $34 million versus, as we're going to see hopefully here tonight, still with Fish and Wildlife, about $175 million or so, with only 3 or 4% general fund in that division. So federal funding, $20.3 million, and then the other funds, real, you know, $14,000. So they have, without the federal dollars, general fund is 96% of the Waters Division funding. And it does present huge challenges for us to deal with that, what many are concerned of is not a renewable resource, but certainly the hydrologic cycle is recharging, but we just aren't recharging, getting the water back into some places where we need to get it fast enough in some cases. And the drought issues Director Lacasmo spoke of are very, very serious that we're facing. I know Lake Superior was recently on the news, 18 inches down, pressures that's pulling it, dust towards it. It's not fun to have to go through some of those drought planning meetings, but the only good thing is it seems to rain out every day we meet. So I told Kent we just have to have more meetings in the summer. So there's no other questions. I would like to move into Fish and Wildlife.
Well, I think we can do that. I was allocating until 8:30. Does that work for members? And maybe we can get through this other piece. Is that okay with members? Mm-hmm. Not okay with members.
You're the boss.
Well, I would sit here. I can sit here by myself, too. Let's do it.
I just have to be over the Senate at 9 a.m., so that's my deadline I have.
We will have a half an hour.
We'll be done by midnight, right?
Oh, it depends on how many members,
I do appreciate all the time you are allowing us to spend with you on our budget. I think the more we have the opportunity to talk about the issues, the challenges, and the outcomes that we're working towards, the better off we will all be as we go moving forward to set the budget up. With that, I'd like to introduce Mr. Dave Shad, our Fish and Wildlife Division Director. Also, we have Ed Bogus, our Assistant Division Director, in the audience, and Pete Squira, our Fiscal Analyst. Or I guess it's not his title anymore. He was a good Fiscal Analyst here. We were able to get him over to the DNR. So, Mr. Shad.
Madam Chair, committee members, again for the record, my name is Dave Shad. I'm Director of DNR Fish and Wildlife Division. I'll start with the pie chart. As Mr. Lacasmo termed it, this is the Jupiter pie chart. We are the largest DNR division. About 25% of the total DNR budget is housed in our division. The largest share of funding comes from the Game and Fish Fund. About 3/4 of our funding comes from Game and Fish Fund. Only about $5 million is directly appropriated from the general fund to the Division of Fish and Wildlife. There is an additional $15.8 million that's appropriated for treaty payments to bands. That money just passes through, and those payments are made directly to the bands as a result of agreements that they have been negotiated by the state with those bands. with that heavy focus on game and fish funding, that kind of drives our mission as well. Most of our management activities are associated with managing populations and habitats for game species, species of interest to hunters and anglers, although a lot of the work that we do certainly provides benefits to other habitats and species that aren't are not hunted. I should make one mention. Within that Game and Fish Fund piece of the pie there are a number of dedicated accounts. These are accounts that are set up in statute, can only be used for specific purposes. The pheasant stamp is an example of one of those dedicated accounts, and each of those accounts comes with it a specific purpose or use. And then a final note on the game and fish appropriations that we receive. There is a budget oversight committee process that's set up in statute to review our uses of that game and fish fund and all the dedicated accounts within the game and fish fund to ensure that our use of those funds meets legislative intent and meets the interests of the license buyers, the stakeholders. Our core functions, again, have a strong focus towards those that are paying the bills, the hunters and anglers. First and foremost, we conserve and restore habitats and populations. We support recreation. There's a lot of work that's involved in conducting hunting seasons, angling seasons, that sort of thing. We collect a lot of scientific information, a lot of data, a lot of inventory of habitats and populations to provide the basis for managing habitats and populations. We also do applied research. We're a science-based organization, and the information that we develop from the monitoring and from the research activities provides a basis for our managers to set seasons and to manage habitats. We have a very ambitious fish stocking program. We've got a large number of lakes in this state and a large number of anglers, over 2 million anglers. And we put a lot of pressure on fishing resources, and we have a very intensive program for managing those resources, and our stocking program is an important part of that. Finally, we provide technical assistance to other agencies to help ensure that work they do will provide support to fish and wildlife and to private landowners with an interest in managing their properties for that purpose. There is a sixth core function that's not reflected on this slide, and it's the licensing function. The Department's License Center is housed within the Division of Fish and Wildlife. That's the center that oversees all of the licensing the department does, not only game and fish licensing, but also snowmobile registrations, ATV registrations, all of that sort of thing. As far as some of the important activities of the division, again, one of the most important is to provide wildlife hunting, trapping, angling, and viewing opportunities. We manage a large number of waters in the state for this purpose. We've got one of the largest state wildlife management area systems of any state in the country. Over 1.2 million acres, primarily in the southern and western portions of the state. We manage a large number of species. And the result of all this is really a huge economic impact to the state. More than $2.2 billion of expenditures for hunting and angling in the state, much of that in rural areas. And so our work is a pretty important economic driver here. Okay. This is an example of one of our habitat and population outcomes or activities, in this case turkey management. You can see the map on the left shows range expansion of turkeys from the southeastern part of the state north and west as a result of our trap and transplant program. On the right shows the results of that work with increasing numbers of permits, which translates into hunting opportunity and increasing harvest as well. We have some 25 of these indicators in our conservation agenda, everything from walleye stocking to wild rice management, duck harvest to hunter and angler satisfaction measures. This is one that you're probably very familiar with. This is the recovery of the Red Lake walleye population, a rather remarkable recovery from the very low populations of walleyes back in the late 1990s. Working with the Red Lake Band, we implemented stocking programs, developed assessment and monitoring proposals jointly with the band, have developed processes to determine safe harvest levels, and from there have developed regulations and were successful in reopening that lake to walleye fishing last summer. A great success story, but we do similar work like this on all of our large walleye lakes, and in fact, most of the lakes that we manage for fisheries have management plans and are managed in a similar way. The last two activities are outcomes that I'll just mention. One is the research that we do to, again, support a lot of our management work. In this case, our testing, our surveillance of deer populations for chronic wasting disease. And we'll talk about another wildlife disease issue later as we get into our initiatives related to bovine tuberculosis. And our final activity that I'd like to highlight here would be some of the education work that we do to try to inform folks to develop that stewardship ethics so that they will be supporters of conservation in the future, and a lot of our educational work that we do out there. Our Minocqua program, our aquatic education program, is probably our largest and best known program, but we've also got our Fishing in the Neighborhoods program, which is a kind of an urban-based program that provides fishing opportunities, our Becoming an Outdoors Woman that provides opportunities for women and families, our Southeast Asian program, which provides outreach and support to that community, which has a real strong interest in hunting and angling, and several other programs. Some critical trends that drove our budgeting process this year. This one isn't a real new one. Habitat loss and fragmentation, it's one that we've been focusing a lot of attention on for years, especially in agricultural areas of the state. And this map has been around for a little bit. On the left, it shows in blue the wetland resources in a small part of a 50-square-mile portion of Jackson County in the mid-1800s. And then on the right, what that looked like in the mid-1900s. Certainly, we're not going to return things to the way they looked in the mid-1800s, but we are trying to put some of that water back in the landscape in strategic areas. In this part of the state, in the prairie pothole portion of the state, we have about 1% of our native prairie resources remaining, about 10% of our wetland resources, and we're working very hard through a number of programs to try to restore some of that very strategically. The second critical trend is agricultural land use. We've seen quite a shift in recent years from small grain and pasture based farming, as shown in the green and blue and orange on the left, to more row crops dominated agriculture, as evidenced by all the white on the map on the right. And row crop agriculture generally isn't as friendly to wildlife as small grain and cattle-based agriculture might be. Some of the conservation programs, like the Conservation Reserve Program, have attempted to put more grass back in the landscape, but those are short-term programs, and certainly, as we're seeing right now, at risk.
Excuse me, Representative Gunther has a question, and he has allies over there, so we need to recognize him.
You know, this is a very close, up close and personal meeting today, tonight. This is Fairmont Township. I can almost see where I live. This is a city of 11,000 people, mm-hmm. with all the corresponding industries, and I'm sure glad you're showing the erosion of agricultural land in the city.
Chair Representative Gunther,
The slide talks about row crops and the change from small grains and other types of cropping to the predominant row crop area.
Tulips. Tulips and roses.
I don't want to send the houses.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, at the top says 1984. I suppose we need to look at our aerial photos and our flat maps again to make sure this slide is more correct as to what's on the ground. I think what we're trying to show here is agricultural changes and trends have caused pressures in conservation and habitat. But as we all know, the availability and the promise of moving towards biofuel production from native prairies will provide us with an incentive to hopefully reverse some of these things. And you're going to hear from our, we're talking in a few minutes about our prairie wetlands complex issue, our working lands initiative, which we're trying to help deal with this. This slide is meant to support that issue, so hopefully you'll understand.
Madam Chairman, I'm surprised the city grew that much.
As soon as I saw Fairmont Township, I knew that was coming.
Moving on, Madam Chair, our last critical trend is participation in recreation, outdoor recreation, and this slide speaks to participation in hunting and fishing. What this is it shows a change in the rate of participation from 2000 to 2005 for various age groups of Minnesota citizens. And the blue lines show rates of participation for fishing and changes in rates of participation for fishing, the red for hunting. So anything below that line shows a lowered rate of participation. That means fewer participants for that age class. Anything above that line would show increasing rates of participation. And you can see that especially for those younger groups of citizens, we're losing ground for both hunting and fishing. We're seeing lower rates of participation. And what we're facing here in Minnesota and other states across the country is kind of a double whammy here. We've got our baby boomers, our largest piece of our largest group as far as population goes, starting to hit retirement age, starting to phase out of hunting and angling activities. We've got smaller age groups coming behind them, so they're not replacing the baby boomers as far as numbers go. They're also not participating at the same rates in outdoor recreation and especially in hunting and fishing at the same rates as the boomers. And so we've got fewer people coming behind these boomers, and they're participating at lower rates. And what that means for the future is probably a lot fewer hunters and anglers unless we can do something to stem that tide. We're concerned about this for a number of reasons. Hunters and anglers are very passionate supporters for conservation. They fund an awful lot of the conservation work that we do here in the state. And we need a strong base of hunters, especially to help us manage populations of deer and geese and other species. And so so this is a trend that we're very concerned with.
Before you go on, Representative Enzels has a question.
Thank you,
and then Representative Packard.
Thank you. Despite all of that, it just seems to me that it's accurate to say that with regard to fishing, there's less pressure on the resource, which comes as kind of a surprise to me. Is that accurate?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's coming. Our numbers have held up pretty well on both hunting and angling. Other states have actually seen some real declines. The lower rates of participation here, looking into the future, will do exactly that. We will see fewer anglers and hunters in the field. Now, some would say that's a good thing. There's more for me, less pressure, a higher quality hunting and angling experience. But with that comes the drawbacks, less revenue, that sort of thing. So.
Representative
Pastor. Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, we heard Representative Norness's bill earlier in Representative Eakin's committee, and this seems contrary to some of the things that we've heard in that committee. So I think it's important that we're going to be seeing Representative Nornes's bill again, and maybe that will help some of those older folks get them out fishing again.
I think you're also going to see a bill from Representative Junkie about Let's Go Fishing that seems to have a lot of folks excited about taking older people fishing. So there are two kind of strains that are coming in here that I think it would be worthwhile to talk about at the same time. Sometimes when you have a trend like this, and it's obviously growing, the 16 to 24-year-olds and the 25 to 34-year-olds, if they don't want to hunt and fish, but to participate in the outdoors in a new direction, are you light enough on your feet to accommodate that?
Madam Chair, you know, the trend that we see for hunting and angling is also reflected in visitations to state and national parks, a demand for boundary waters permits. It's kind of across the board, and so this isn't just a challenge for us as a Fish and Wildlife Division. It's really something that the whole department is kind of focused on. The other piece of this is that a lot of our education, our outreach work, is as much education as it is recruitment and retention. For example, our Minocqua program is really an aquatic education program. It has a fishing or an angling component to it, but first and foremost, we want to develop an appreciation for aquatic resources so that these young people grow up with that conservation ethic, with that understanding of the need to manage and protect those resources. Along with that, if we can develop them into anglers, I think that would be a good thing as well. So I think as a department, we're interested in just getting people more engaged in all aspects of outdoor recreation. Our particular focus is hunting and angling, but it's a department-wide effort, fairly.
I just think of other kinds of occasions when people go to parks, and maybe our family is different, but trying to get a spot for a large family in a park for a family reunion is a challenge. It's a real challenge. So people are saying, well, is it going to be next July this or July that? And they're talking now. So maybe the way people participate is somewhat different, and we're not quite ready for that participation.
And Madam Chair, that's a great point. And we've done some survey work to try to determine what expectations people have for their outdoor recreation experience, and it is changing. People and families aren't interested in the same things that they might have been in the past. Some of that has to do with lifestyle. People are busier, more organized activities, that kind of thing. They don't have as much time, and so we need to look for ways, for opportunities to change the kinds of opportunity that we're provided, that we're providing to folks to try to fit in with that interest that they're expressing. It's very challenging, very complicated, and I think we're just getting into this and learning as we go here.
Do you provide day camps for children?
Madam Chair, from an angling and hunting standpoint, we don't. We do have an archery in schools program that provides archery shooting opportunity after school hours and that kind of thing. Some of the conservation organizations, Minnesota Waterfowl Association, for example, has a woody camp where they bring in young waterfowlers and kind of show them the ropes. The Minnesota Deer Hunters Association has a four-corn camp. Ducks Unlimited has a Green Wings program. So some of the groups have developed kind of that day camp type of an approach to get kids engaged and interested.
The and this isn't your division, but I wonder if Park has thought about that. I mean, if you want to get kids engaged early and outdoors, they spend time outdoors in the summer, they're engaged. I mean, that's just what happens to little kids,
mm-hmm.
and they'll stay that way. But it's other people have questions? Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You know, this isn't like my grocery store. When business is down, I can fire a few people and maybe cut my store hours or whatever it takes. I know what you said. Whatever it takes. That was the wrong word. I know that. Lay people off. How's that better? But anyway, and we have this wonderful natural resource. It's not going to shrink, and hopefully it doesn't get so we can ignore any part of it. And it seems to me like this is the best time in the world I can think of appropriating money, Madam Chairman, for marketing, hunting and fishing and our natural resources, even more than we are now. Right now, the only people that are basically doing it is the tourism industry, and there are fewer and fewer resorts that can afford to do this. So maybe we should probably advertise through the DNR a little bit more and have them promote this wonderful resource that we have. And I can't think of a better way, because the amount of lakes isn't going to go down. Hopefully the 18 inches will be made up in Lake Superior out of the 1,700 feet. But I really think that now's the time to point out the positive things about Minnesota's natural resources, hunting, fishing, hiking, birding, all of those things. And I for one, would be very, very happy to author a bill to do that, because it's time to do it before the trend gets critical.
It's something we can certainly discuss in committee, Representative Gunther, but one of the things that advertisers do is they look at their audiences. And when I look at these young folks and I look at the age and who's not hunting and fishing, I'm not sure telling them go hunting and fishing is going to get them hunting and fishing. But if we're kind of going where they want to go, and providing camping opportunities for families, it might be different.
Representative Haas and I were talking in my office today. And we were both talking about the facts that my dad and his dad never took him fishing. But he just took his dad fishing for the first time in years. 17 days later, his dad died. What an experience, a memorable time that man will have, I think, all his life. And I didn't take my dad, but I got to take my stepdad, and we had a wonderful time. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. So maybe it's time that we promote that. Hey, invite your dad fishing. I think anything we can do to get people to enjoy that resource that we are justifiably proud of, I think we should do.
I don't know that it works. I have to tell you,
Marketing works.
Gunther, I grew up, believe it or not, in a boat fishing all the time because I was the best of the scalers of the fish. So I was always invited along, okay? That's what happens, right?
I didn't have those skills. We had bullheads. We skinned them.
Well, I could scale fish. And we used to go crabbing all the time because we lived on the shore. My kids don't see fishing as interesting at all. So in one generation, you can't turn around now and tell them, go fishing, it'll be fun. It's like talking to a wall. But I can tell them to go out in the woods and take their kids out in the woods and take a walk in the woods, and they'll go, right like that.
I'm thinking that we need
to be thinking about going where people are and not telling people where they ought to be.
Maybe you should shut the computers and the iPods off for a week.
But I think we need to continue with this.
Madam Chair,
and we'll tell the rest of our fishing stories.
The opportunities, especially, and the support, you know, we have on Mother's Day, take your mother fishing. So maybe we can look at trying to do something for Father's Day or other ways to promote. And if you give me a second, we'll talk about recruitment and retention and marketing in one of our change items here. We have several change items related to the Fish and Wildlife Division, the first being Prairie Wetlands Complex. It's on page 105 of your budget book, or on the fact sheet, it's probably easier to go to that, on page 39. This proposal helps us to actually take the Working Lands Initiative and move it forward. It provides the backbone, if you will, for the Working Lands Initiative and the funding we need to continue that program's success. The goals that we have right now related to prairie wetlands, the summary goal, preserve, restore, and enhance the grassland wetland complexes on public and private lands. You can see this next slide, prairie lands. It shows this is what we call a thunderstorm map. The red squiggly line outlines where the prairie pothole region, that's the border of it. To the left or to the west of that is where the prairie pothole region was. The gray shaded area are where we recognize the abilities to create these large 4 to 9 mile square complexes of grasslands and wetlands. To do this, we need to work with partners, Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Nature Conservancy, Minnesota Waterfowl Association, NRCS, Board of Water Soil Resources, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, among others, to unify and coordinate and improve the conservation investments in this area. This slide here of Lake Moriah shows kind of an example on the ground of what we're working for. You can see the Working Lands Initiative target area in the pink, some CREP projects that we're working on with some Working Lands Initiative funding, proposed wildlife management area acquisitions, and CRP and other programs that are there. The backbone and the beauty of this program is taking all of these things, sitting down with the landowner at their kitchen table or wherever we can get with them, and outline to them what's available to them, how they work, how they can participate and apply different programs on their land, and keep it in private ownership. Another part of this, you can see this slide here, just talks about where we need to go. Our goal and our duck plan we laid out about a month and a half or a while ago. We need to create habitat to support 1 million breeding pairs of ducks. 1 million breeding ducks is what we recommend or what we think we need to sustain a population. To do that, our long-term target is to protect an additional 2 million acres of prairie wetlands and grasslands while maintaining our existing base. The annual target we're trying to achieve is 40,000 acres annually. So, Representative Guinness, I know that takes a long time, but this is a long-term goal. And getting these deals together, Mr. Representative Gunther, do you have your calculator over there? Getting these deals together takes some time, but there also are just financial capabilities that we have to deal with and restraints. What this program will do, or what we want to do with this funding, we're working on getting an outline description for this for you so we can hand out to committee. $180,000 of this proposal would be used to increase and enhance our coordination activities. $270,000 we'll be using to develop and integrate our grassland conservation and biofuels work that we're doing to work with the issues and the programs you folks are looking at in developing and putting into place. $200,000 for the wetland enhancement and for waterfall recovery activities. And $450,000 for enhancing our conservation delivery mechanisms that we have in place. The goal for this is to develop and work on to provide leadership to develop best management practices, marketing strategies, product delivery, and financial incentives to implement new grassland-based business models that support wildlife conservation, and also increase the energy capabilities, carbon sequestration, water quality, all of those components we're talking a lot about these days, onto the ground to keep the land in private ownership where possible, to provide access to people to hunt, provide water quality, all within these large complexes that we need to have to maintain the million ducks that we recommend we need. You can see this slide here talks about duck populations, Minnesota duck breeding populations from 1970 to 2005. And that target I talked about, actually by 2056, to restore a productive breeding population averaging 1 million that will produce a fall population of 1.4 million ducks for Minnesota. It's a huge challenge, but we need to start talking about it and start working on this stuff as fast as we can, as much as we can right now. And I think that the opportunities we have tying a bunch of different factors together really are going to hopefully catapult us into the future on this.
Just one piece of information that would be helpful to have
as we are looking to bring in new lands and restore wetlands and try to make them functioning, which we're not really good at yet, what's the cost of that per acre to enforce and make sure that people aren't destroying old wetlands? I mean, we've heard some horror stories at the wetlands conference about our loss of wetlands and our enforcement that just seems to be scattershot and not focused. So it does seem intuitive that it would be a lot less expensive to keep what we have than to keep giving it away because we are, and then trying to redo it someplace else. So if we could get some numbers on that, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, we will work on that. It's going to be somewhat of a judgmental number, but we'll work with other agencies to figure out what that may be. Also looking at programs like our Eye in the Sky that we've done, just completed with our conservation officers, and the flying program working with counties. Those types of things are what we need to continue to do. Also, I think our land record management system will allow us to do some of that enforcement monitoring activities much easier using overlays and updating ortho photos with easement borders on them, so we can look at in an office or on a computer firsthand to see if there has been activities that have encroached or caused damage to those wetlands. We'll see what we can get for you, though, the best information we can. Present populations, this slide is there. Another part of this also, the ducks are one benefit. Pheasant populations certainly are another big part. And you can see our target here, achieve an annual harvest of 450,000 pheasants by 08 and 750,000 pheasants by 2025. And the target really requires a habitat base that can support an average fall population of 3 million pheasants. So you can see we're looking long-term on these things as well, recognizing the needs for preserving these lands. Moving on to the next piece or change item dealing with hunting, angling, hunting, and recruitment and retention. What we're looking for here is we're seeking $150,000, and this would be out of the Heritage Enhancement Account, to improve our recruitment and retention activities. $100,000 of these funds would be used to coordinate our existing hunting and angling youth programs, working with the mentors we have, probably, hopefully, tapping into some of our hunter safety education training individuals and other people who are working with us, coordinating those with existing mentoring programs, such as the Big Brother and Big Sister Pass It On program, working with these mentorship programs that are there and taking the expertise that we know we have in our volunteers and tying them together and getting people out into the field who've never had the opportunity before, who have don't have the access to equipment, perhaps, and things like that, don't have the knowledge. Trying to increase those relationships and look where we're at, trying just to be more effective. Establishing mentoring program liaisons within existing hunting and fishing organizations. Director Shad talked about the Woody Camp and the Forkhorn Camp, looking at trying to take some of their expertise and bringing it into other mentor programs, not only in the metro area, but really statewide is where we need to go. A small piece of this as well will be used, $50,000 we would like to use for marketing. Looking at the successes some of our other states have done. Recently, Iowa conducted a marketing campaign to boost fishing license sales. They were able to sell an additional 22,000 fishing licenses, increasing their sales by 8% by going into their database that they have and looking at people who haven't bought a fishing license for a couple of years. The marketing tools that are out there and doing some simple things like that, it will cost us a little bit of money, but the return hopefully will be getting people back in and getting new people in and establishing those relationships once again.
I think Representative Gunther has a question, and I am looking at the time when I promised to leave here.
This, I promise, is my last statement. You know, you could double the amount you plan on advertising by just asking Berkeley Tackle Company and Spirit Lake, Iowa to match it. And you can go to Crestliner Boat and they'll do the same thing. And then you go to a couple shotgun companies and they'll do the same thing. Leverage your money like tourism does and you will have a lot of money to spend, and that's what we need.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, we are looking at that. We do some of that. We need to do more of it. So thank you. Would you like to stop, Madam Chair, or?
I think I'd ask the committee what they would like to do.
Ready.
You, ready to stop?
Yes.
I think folks are ready to stop, and we will continue this on Tuesday, and we'll get it all done, the rest of DNR done on Tuesday.
We will, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Questions? Do you want to go into your budget issues?
Yes, Madam Chair, I will.